Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, we're going to talk with Katie McGinty, Pennsylvania gubernatorial candidate. Going to be here to talk about her vision for the Commonwealth. You know, I'm looking across the span of Democratic candidates for the May 20th primary going, you know, the vast majority of them, I think all of them in one form or another, much better than the guy we've got now. Even as you get down to the bottom of the Democratic ticket, I don't know that you can be much worse than this guy, which is why I think got to go. Also on the program yesterday, the House overwhelmingly approved the budget. Yeah, amazing. It was pretty sizable. Today, the Senate followed. So a collective, woohoo! We have a budget all the way through the end of September. When was the last time that happened? When was the last time we actually had a budget? I mean, we just passed one that was 3 days long, because that's kind of how we've been running our country, on short-term continuing resolutions to where, hey, can't wait for the next hostage situation to come around. Well, nothing yet until the end of September, October 1st. So put that on the calendar. Look forward to it right before election time. So that ought to be interesting. The next thing I'm looking for is the debt ceiling fight, which, you know, maybe right around springtime we can be looking forward to. So there you go. Also, MLK, Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday is coming. His birthday was yesterday, obviously. Just around the corner. Question is, how has the dream fared? There is a new report out looking at the racial divide. And I know, you've got these extremist element in the Republican Party looking down their noses, pointing the fingers. They're just lazy or stupid or drug addicts. Love that one. Our governor's key line. But we have some, honestly and truthfully, some very real, very serious divides between the haves and the have-nots, and we'll talk about that. Also, a number of emails on the paycheck deception poison being peddled by our Republican legislators here in Pennsylvania, and so much more. Your questions, comments, thoughts, whatever's on your mind, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Again, like I said, big movement on the budget. In fact, I was shocked at the number of people who voted in favor in the Senate. 17 Republicans joined all of the Democrats, 72-26 in the Senate, to see the budget move forward. And you had a huge amount in the Senate as well. I mean, it was the vast majority, or in the House, which tells me a few things, maybe. Maybe all of the people paying attention, being outraged, calling your representative, saying, you know what, do your jobs. Maybe that has pulled the Republicans back from the brink of insanity. I'm not saying it has, but maybe on a few things. Now, understand, this budget was not the greatest thing in the world, but it wasn't the austerity, screw-quester budget that the Republicans wanted. And you go back and you think about all of the austerity that they pitched. Maybe there's part of me that thinks, maybe they possibly, I'm not putting a lot of credence in this, but possibly they saw their ideology not working. This idea that we can gut spending, we can fire people en masse, and somehow the magic fairy will come and sprinkle job dust on us and jobs will just sprout up. Hasn't happened. Which brings me back here to Pennsylvania. You know, we've got a governor who is one of those ideologues, one of those people looking at the austerity measures and saying, hey, I like it. Let's gut $1 billion from education each of the last 3 years, 20,000 education professionals to the curb. And those are 20,000 jobs, which in turn create other jobs because, you know, it's just that snowball effect thing. What's interesting, and you look at history, and this is why I think this is such an interesting election cycle. Understand, Pennsylvania has voted against the party of a sitting president in 18 of the last 19 gubernatorial contests since 1938, with Democrats losing 16 of the last 17 gubernatorial races with a Democrat in the White House since 1860. The last incumbent governor to lose re-election while the opposition party controlled the White House was back in 1854, a guy named William Bigler. I would guess for those who live in Biglersville, kind of probably why. There you go. But you know, you look at this and you go, the numbers, the history really stacked against anyone beating Corbyn. And had he done, understand, had he done anything reasonable, had he not really bought and drank the Kool-Aid of the radical right wing, I think he would have coasted to a very easy victory. Had he not followed the Koch brother Walker scheme, had he not gone after and done, now understand, on a much lighter scale than we saw in Wisconsin or Ohio or Michigan or Indiana, on a much lighter scale, but still there. The fortunate thing for him is he kind of, for a while, flew under the radar. He's not as insane as Paul LePage in Maine. He's not the magnet, the lightning rod that Scott Walker in Wisconsin or Scott in Florida is. Kind of does that whole Punxsutawney Phil thing. You know, he pops out, says a couple things, causes a little trouble, then back into his hole. But even with all of this, with all of the history on his side, I still think he's going to go down for the sole reason is that things have gotten so bad. And the priorities of the state are so backwards. It shows me he has virtually no leadership skills whatsoever. And the few that he does have are bought and paid for by the shale industry or the Koch brothers or the education industry. It just seems to me that there's no real vision there. And, you know, I got to ask the question. You know, 4 more years of dictatorial rule by a very authoritarian legislature and a visionless governor, you kind of got to go, where do we end up in 4 years after that? What kind of a mess do we then inherit? What kind of a state are we? Are we South Carolina? Are we Alabama? Are we those states that have serious, serious structural problems? Are we those states? Or are we worse? Do we have, you know, one of the things I love about Pennsylvania is we still kind of have a little bit of a middle class. Are we moving towards absolute polarization where the haves have and the have-nots don't? Now understand, this primary season, the Republicans right now, they are lining up with the big moneyed interests to primary anybody who doesn't go along with the corporate line. That's reality. We have got to be vigilant. We have got to be aware of what's going on. But the sad thing is, and this is what's infuriating to me on so many levels, when the Koch brothers come to town, they have built such an amazing network of the Commonwealth Foundation and the PA Independent and all of these little think tanks and all of these little media outlets that the money gets filtered through, that we really don't get to know who's behind these oh so wonderful, sweet sounding messages, focus group tested, Koch brother approved. You know, one of the ones that's on my radar right now is paycheck protection. Oh, I love that one. They're going to protect my paycheck. No more wage theft, right? Wrong. No more cheating me out of overtime. Wrong. No more making me take breaks and punching me out while I was still working. Wrong. What it's going to do? And, you know, because look, you know, when they run their polling, and we're going to talk a little bit about their polling later, when they run that, they throw them out. Do you think we should be protecting people's paychecks? And what idiot would go, no, heck with you, let's steal people's paychecks. That's not how it works. But they have this language, and look, They spend millions and millions of dollars testing their bumper sticker slogans. They spend millions and millions of dollars and have the best Madison Avenue marketing firms coming up with the best pitch lines. Look, these are the people who got us to buy water out of bottles. These are people who got us to buy rocks and call it a pet. These people are masterful at showing you something that isn't even real and telling you, you need to have this. These are the marketeers. These people, they get it. If they pound it into us hard enough and long enough, we're going to buy it. And I'm hoping at some point in the very near future, and I think I'm seeing it. You know, I had an interesting couple of conversations today with people about the paycheck deception, destruction, diversion act, whatever you want to call it. It's anything but protection. And I had a couple of these moments where, you know, the person you're talking to goes, well, it sounds right, but what is it? And that's what I want. When we hear this rhetoric and we hear these nice, soft commercials saying, oh, you should have the right to have your paycheck protected, go, well, yeah, I think I have that under federal law. But tell me what you're talking about. What does that mean? To me, that's where we have to be. We have to be questioning and then questioning who's pushing this poison, who's behind it. And once you find out who's behind it, they're the same people who've caused virtually all of the problems in this country for generations, our folks on Wall Street. They're the mega wealthy. They're the folks who we've given huge amounts of tax cuts to. We've given huge subsidies to. We've created this lifestyle for them that it's never enough. They want more. And now that we've given it to them, they're using it to say, we want more and we're going to take it. And by the way, we're going to silence your ability to fight us. That's what this is really all about. All of the rhetoric we're going to hear on paycheck deception, on right to work, on any of this stuff, is about capital crushing labor. It's that simple. Anything that you're going to hear about it, that's what it's about. It's about the rich guy taking some money out of his pocket to spend a bunch of money on ads and a bunch of money telling you, you don't need those unions. They're bad for you. And their end game? Your wallet, your savings account, your standard of living, your voice crushed. That's what it's about. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Katie McGinty. Stick around. Right back after this. And take your money. All they want to do is add up. And take your money. All they want to do is add up. And take your money. All they want to do is add up. And take your money. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. United Auto Workers President Bob King told the German newspaper that the UAW will represent workers in the Chattanooga, Tennessee VW plant by June. VW's German workers are unionized, represented by IG Metall. The UAW has urged VW to put a German-style works council in place in Tennessee. Under U.S. labor law, the workers would have to be in a union for the works council to be set up. The UAW says a clear majority of VW workers in Chattanooga want to be represented by the UAW. VW has called for a formal vote by employees and says it will accept the workers' decision. Right-wing anti-union groups, though, are fighting the UAW organizing effort. Republican U.S. Senator Bob Corker has said that if the VW plant is organized by the UAW, it would have a domino effect on other non-union auto plants in the South. UAW President Bob King told KPBS Radio that the union is stressing cooperation with VW in this campaign, and right-wing fears that the union will be bad for business are unfounded.
They get pressured by the right wing of the party. Unfortunately, that's a fear that these politicians have that overcomes common sense. Campaigns that we have going on currently are being run very differently than we've run campaigns in the past.
In addition to VW in Tennessee, the UAW is campaigning to organize BMW, Daimler, and Nissan plants in Alabama, South Carolina, and Mississippi. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says it's appalling that Senate Republicans are refusing to extend unemployment benefits with no strings attached. For now, efforts to extend those benefits are stalled in the Senate. Meanwhile, the AFL-CIO says millions of Americans who want work but can't find it are facing more weeks without much-needed benefits. One of them is Dale Jakowiak of Warren, Michigan.
Hardship-wise, I've already pulled $10,000 out of my 401, of which at the end of this month I'll have depleted that and probably have to do that again. You know, what I was getting in the federal benefits was modest, but because I live modest, it was enough to keep the rent paid and, you know, the gas and the electric paid. So, you know, that makes quite a difference.
The AFL-CIO says Congress should stop playing games with jobless benefits, or working families should force them out of their jobs in November. The International Association of Machinists could become the first union representing employees at Amazon. A small group of 30 Amazon workers in Delaware are voting on whether or not to join the union. IAM spokesperson John Carr says a union win could lead to other Amazon workers joining the IAM.
A strategic plan would probably come together and we would start looking at what other locations or within the location on how to go forward.
To support Workers Independent News, donate now at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. That's right. Tomorrow is going to be here soon enough. And I got to be honest with you, as I was looking over the governor's Facebook page and all of the stock photos of him with Canadian farmers, just kind of makes me chuckle. But, you know, you look at the rhetoric, you look at the stuff. The post that I love the most is he calls himself the More Jobs Governor. More than Wyoming, I guess. Okay, I'll give you that. More than Wyoming. But all of this rhetoric about all created 200,000 jobs in the shale industry doesn't hold up to scrutiny. And that's the thing that I get. It seems very disingenuous and, well, just divisive. And I think that has to come to an end at some point, where the ugliness that's coming up here in the next couple of months just comes to a complete stall. But with the primary coming up, mark your calendars, May 20th, 2014, the primary day is, and that's when we're going to decide who is going to take on Tom Corbett in November. And I've got one of the folks who has thrown her hat into the ring, so to speak. She was the former secretary of the Department of Environmental Protection here in Pennsylvania, Katie McGinty. Katie, thanks for taking time for us.
Please too, and thanks for all the good work you're doing out there.
Yeah, you know, I look at this, and you know, the More Jobs Governor, and you know, I guess more than Wyoming, that's something, but I don't think it's enough.
Well, you know what? Unless people think that it's just Tom Tea Party Corbett, you know, squeezing government jobs. Hey, he's got us dead last in the region in private sector jobs. You know, we grew at a whopping 0.3%. Many other states are just cleaning our clock. I mean, we've lost jobs in every sector. We've lost wages. Families are falling behind. And this guy, far from giving us a hand up, is just pushing us further back still.
Now, you know, on the jobs front, you know, I'm hearing the same voices I heard in Wisconsin and Indiana and other places where they went after workers' rights to organize, that if we could just steal jobs from other people, that would make us better because, you know, our ideology is we don't believe workers should have rights and we should make sure that the companies are fat and happy. I got to be honest, at some point that rhetoric comes to light and we realize it's, one, factually dishonest and wrong, but two, not the way I want to build an economy.
No, absolutely right. I mean, this is a strategy of division. Long time, it's a strategy that would take money out of education so that people don't even know enough to be able to defend themselves. But we have a chance to turn this around and build an economy that's going to enable good salaries, that's going to enable people to build a secure future for themselves. You know, I'm going to be a governor that's about those jobs that provide good wages, good benefits, and a secure retirement.
Now, I look at this, and, you know, since you were the secretary of the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection, you know, especially now when you look at what happened in West Virginia and all of those things, you know, I look at this governor and basically just saying to the drillers, go ahead, do what you want to do. We're not going to tax you. In fact, we're going to pull West Virginia down with us. What do we do? If you're a governor, what's the direction in the shale industry? What are you thinking?
Well, see, here's what we need to do. I mean, we do need to put a reasonable shale severance tax in place. But what I really want to do is use that shale gas to drive a resurgence of manufacturing in Pennsylvania. Let's produce the gas, but then don't put it just in a pipe to send overseas. Let's use the dollars to train our workers. Look, we need pipe fitters. We need welders. We need machinists, heavy equipment operators. These are the jobs that we can and should have. But then what I'd like to do, and way back in the day, I studied chemistry and I was a chemist, so I think about these things in that way. Look, we can use the gas as a feedstock to lead the country in making chemicals and pharmaceuticals and life sciences and plastics, all the things that you make from the carbon and hydrogen that makes up natural gas. That's where we should be. You know, we should be the renaissance of manufacturing in the United States, and it's going to be high-tech, clean manufacturing. We can compete and win there, but this guy seems to have no interest in trying and seems to have no faith in the Pennsylvania worker. I have utter faith in the Pennsylvania worker. I know we can compete and win.
Yeah, I'm with you. But, you know, I look at this guy, and it's rare that I say a politician has no leadership skills or vision. And when I look at him, I just don't see either. I see a guy who comes out, you know, says what he's supposed to, and then back into his hole, and with no idea of where we're heading. That's my fear, that in four more years, if he's reelected, we're South Carolina.
Well, you know, once a prosecutor, I guess always a prosecutor, and I feel like he's always sort of sneaking around a corner to see if he can do a gotcha, you know, on somebody. So this whole trumped up issue of voter identification, 2.5 years and our tax dollars wasted, when the judge keeps asking him, Governor, show me a case of voter fraud, and then maybe we'll allow you to move forward with this. Not a single case, not one. But what he wants to do is disempower anyone from speaking for him or herself to build a bright future for themselves. We see that today, a legislature that should be working hard to create jobs. What are they doing? They're tying up the legislature with the governor's encouragement in looking to dismantle the ability of people to join unions, be part of unions, and efficiently pay their dues. Union.
Yeah, it's amazing. And one of the things, for the guy who calls himself the More Jobs Governor, he has single-handedly destroyed the solar industry in this country, in this commonwealth.
Yeah, you're not kidding. Listen, I was proud when I was secretary, and this builds from when I had the privilege of working with President Clinton in the White House. You know, we drove forward a clean economy, but it was an economy that created 22 million jobs. When I was secretary in Pennsylvania, we became the number one manufacturer of renewable energy equipment in the United States. We were number one in wind, number two in solar. You know, and if there is an equivalent of treason at the state level, to me it's when a governor not only fails to create jobs, but it goes aggressively against good manufacturing jobs, jobs paying $70,000 a year. But that's what Governor Corbett did. He became a governor that fought Washington, D.C. in providing tax credits for wind energy manufacturing, even though we had thousands of jobs in Pennsylvania paying great wages. They were unionized jobs, steel worker jobs, and he actively fought against them.
Could that have been the reason why? I mean, the fact that I look at the party that controls our state with dictatorial control and their hatred of workers who are organized. Just, I mean, when you talk to them, you can feel that hatred.
Well, look what we're doing now. You know, so backdoor deals to try to sell off the lottery that has been hailed across the country as an efficiently operated lottery that produces revenue. governor wants to take those unionized jobs away and hand them over to a foreign company. No bid, no daylight. And then we see that now, too. Yeah, sure, let's modernize our liquor stores. Everybody'd like a little more convenience. But guess what? Those are good jobs, and we know that rural areas of our state will not be served if we fully privatize. Let's modernize those stores, keep those good jobs that we have, and enable us ourselves to grow the revenues through modernization. But that's not his agenda. His agenda is to dismantle those things that he can't fully control, wants to control, and has no interest in growing the state in a way that families can thrive.
Listen to the Rick Smith Show with Katie McGinty, Democratic gubernatorial candidate. Her website, katiemcginty.com. We've got a link at therickSmithShow.com. Just click on her name, and it'll take you right there. You know, I look at all of these privatization schemes and the priorities that our governor has undertaken. And again, I use this, his frame of the more jobs governor, because I find it mockable on one end, but tragic on another. These privatization schemes, be it the lottery, be it the liquor store, be it whatever else they can hawk off. One, we've spent huge amounts of money chasing these schemes with no results and nothing positive to come out of it at a time when we've got so many problems in our Commonwealth. You look at the Medicaid expansion money that he could take to put people back to work immediately. And I gotta go, you know, is it a lie? Is it wishful thinking, the whole more jobs governor thing? Because it doesn't look to me, factually, even close to accurate.
No, listen, he's running it supposedly on jobs and education, and yet he's dismantled education, and we are dead last in private sector jobs in the region. We have fallen from 7th to 47th in the country in job creation. And real quick, on pensions, let's make one thing clear. The governor's pension proposal to force everyone into a 401k makes the situation worse.
Yep.
It makes the situation worse. And let's also recognize that the state employees are the only people in the pension equation who never missed a payment. They've been faithful. They've earned a secure retirement. And it's time for the governor to step up, for the Commonwealth to meet its obligations, drive the economy forward, not push people out of a secure retirement while actually increasing the tab that the taxpayers will pay.
Well, what's interesting there is, you know, the workers actually honored their end of the contract.
Exactly.
And the guy who was the top cop in this state for a couple of years, not so much. It was, well, now look, the pension thing goes back years and years, the Ridge and all the way forward. It wasn't only him, but he's one of them.
It wasn't him. That's very fair. But what you say also is absolutely fair and doesn't get said enough. And that is that the employee never missed a payment. The Commonwealth has taken a holiday from contributing its obliged share of meeting those pension obligations. And so now the governor's proposal would actually worsen that situation by writing into a law an extension of these artificial caps in terms of how much the Commonwealth will pay. Well, listen, what would our credit rating look like if you and I decided we'd rack up a big Christmas present bill and tell Visa, listen, we're going to just artificially cap how much we're paying you back? I think we'd get tossed out and we'd see that our payments and our obligations would worsen. They wouldn't get better.
They'd come get us.
But let me say this. I mean, look, we should add a big note of optimism here. We have a chance to go forward to the polls and replace this guy with someone who can drive the economy forward. Pennsylvania has, one, a great workforce. Two, we've got terrific natural resources in water and gas that we can develop responsibly with an environmental cop on the beat. We're the Keystone State. We're in a great location to serve the biggest buying market in the world. So the future is ours. If we get positive, visionary leadership that believes in the workforce, the men and women of Pennsylvania, and wants to create an economy where there's opportunity for all, that's not just an aspiration. That's what we can and, by golly, should be, because we have all the right stuff to make that happen. And it's just boy, can we make November happen tomorrow? Because I want to get started on that positive future.
I'm right behind you on that. So a couple of quick things then. The Medicaid expansion and setting up the exchanges. Does Governor McGinty do that?
In a heartbeat. You know, when everybody from social welfare advocates to the leaders of the chambers of commerce in our various communities come forward and say, expanding Medicaid does, one, cover 600,000 Pennsylvanians, two, infuses $40 billion into our economy, and three, creates 40,000 new jobs. You know, some choices are hard as governor, and some aren't. You say yes to that in a heartbeat.
And you don't have to pay for it. I mean, that's the other part of it. It comes with for the first 3 years at 100%.
Right.
And you can opt out whenever you want. It seems like a no-brainer.
It does. And not only that, but to me, hey, guess what? We have paid for it because we're Pennsylvanians. We pay our taxes to the federal government. As Governor Corbett has said no to these resources, well, our federal tax dollars aren't going to sit in Washington. They're going to go to residents of other states who will benefit while our citizens are harmed. That, to me, is crazy. You know, one of the places that we are on the cutting edge is in life sciences and health care. This would help to grow those industries where we're already competing and doing well. We could add more good jobs there while covering 600,000 Pennsylvanians with the dignity of health care that every person deserves and no family can survive without. Let's do that. Let's do that immediately.
It seems to me to just to be a common right, you know, the pursuit of life, happiness, you know, all of that.
Yeah, let's really stand up for the dignity of life. Let's make sure that people have education, health care, decent wages. And by the way, Governor McGinty would also drive forward an increase in the minimum wage as, you know, bill number one. And in fact, we should use the correct language. We're not even increasing the minimum wage. We're really just trying to restore it to something that it resembled even 20 years ago. You know, in 1968, in real terms, the minimum wage was $10 an hour.
Yep.
You know, here we are at $7.25. Just think about that. You know, it's shameful that someone could work a full 40-hour week. Some people are working two jobs, and yet they're still in poverty. That's not the way to treat people with respect. It's also, frankly, not the way that an economy can thrive, let alone survive. You know, this is a grave thing that we need to attend to make sure that anyone willing to work hard is able to earn a decent wage. And here's one thing that I think is also optimistic for us. It seems that economist after economist now, and the Wall Street Journal even repeatedly is reporting that the reason our recovery has been so sluggish is specifically because wages have not kept pace. The message is out there clear. If we want to grow our economy, just be mercenary about it. Don't think about what's right. Just think about what's going to create a thriving economy. We have to pay people more. We have to restore the consumer's purchasing power to stimulate the economy and grow. So if for no other reason, let's pay people a decent wage that they can help to grow the economy for us.
I'm right there with you. And for me, it comes back down to we need to strengthen labor unions, not destroy them, so that they have the ability to bargain for better wages. But, you know, you go back and you look at up until the Reagan years, productivity and wage growth kept pace. And had the minimum wage kept pace with the productivity that we've enjoyed for the last 30 years, the minimum wage would be over $20 an hour.
Yeah, see, there it is. And that is the kind of wage where you can begin to hope to put food on the table and a couple bucks, you know, away so that your kids can look to college or training or skill set development after high school. And then they become productive citizens in the economy. You know, another thing that I think we need to look at very carefully as a society is how many tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars every year are we sending to more prisons and to incarcerating more young people. My goodness, how about if we begin to invest in our schools, in skills development and training? How about partnering with unions that have incredible facilities to enable skills development. Put our dollars there instead of putting our kids on this trajectory, you know, from school to prison and then no man's land in terms of their future.
I'm with you. The last line of questioning I've got for you, because it seems like you're reading my notes, what I've been preparing. I go, this is kind of the flow I was going with. But the education front, I think there has to be a huge investment, not this, you know, we're gonna make a small little tiny increase so we can say in a speech that we raised our spending on education. There needs to be a massive investment in universal pre-K programs. And I think the way you do it is, and I don't know what your position on charter schools are, but this experiment has failed. Do away with this idea that we're going to spend all of this boatload of money on these charter schools, where almost daily across this country we're seeing them fail.
Well, listen, I think, one, we do need to restore those dollars, and I think we can, and I've proposed to dedicate the severance tax on shale gas, every dollar, to education. It's not just about dollars, though. For me, like you are emphasizing, one, it's early childhood education. Two, it's get those class sizes down. Give a teacher a fighting chance to reach kids in the class. And third, instead of just beating up teachers, I would invest in professional development, and I'd invest in science, technology, engineering, math, and the arts. STEM and the arts for our kids. That's where the competition is in this world. Let's prepare our kids. As to the charters, you know, I think that we need to have an outlook here. What's good for the kids? There are some charters, I think, that have served well in some neighborhoods, but by and large, they're not living up to the same standards as the other public district schools. There's been criminality in these schools. People pocketing the money for themselves, lining their own pockets. I would open up the whole system.
Yeah, I'll be honest with you.
Transparency.
I'll be honest with you. I was not against the concept when Albert Schenker brought it out. The concept of innovations of laboratories of innovations. I'm in favor of it. Personally, I wish I could send my kids to a Montessori school because I agree with that kind of hands-on experiential learning. To me, that's important. But my sixth grade daughter sits in a classroom in the LGI, large group instruction, with 100 kids.
Yeah, it's just impossible. You cannot do that. And just to touch on one other thing related to this, where we spend our money and squander it, I think it's gotten out of hand with all of the standardized testing.
Yep.
My own three girls who are in public school, my eighth graders are looking at one of the twins will be facing 6 weeks of standardized tests this year, and the other is 8 weeks, 2 months of precious school time, all dedicated to these standardized tests. That is not productive use of precious time in developing learning and capability. And frankly, it just kills our kids' spirit and creativity and their desire to learn when they're strapped to a desk, filling in black ovals in circles for 6 or 8 weeks.
Which is why I opted my daughter out of the test last year, because I'll give you a real quick story.
Yeah.
You know, here I have an 11, 7, and a 5-year-old. And my 11-year-old is playing school with the other two. And from the other room you hear, now we've got to pass these tests, because if we don't pass the test, they're going to take money away from the school and they're going to close our school. So pay attention and do this. And I'm going, whoa, whoa, whoa. This is not playing to me.
No. See, that is... not the way we need to go, but I think we do need to know the way that we can go. We can thrive and prosper. One other thing, by the way, you know, in terms of where Pennsylvania should be shining, there's no other state in the nation, here's some good stats, that wins more grants in research and things like life sciences. Our schools are good. They compete. They win. There's no other state that gets more patents for the research that we do, and no other state that produces more PhDs. And yet what happens? Instead of taking all that good stuff and translating it into new businesses in our communities that will be hiring people, we turn the other way, and all of that research then goes to California or Austin, Texas, or Boston, and that's where the businesses get started.
Right.
You know, what I want to do is grab investment dollars, put them in the hands of local people who will grow new businesses on the basis of this innovation that we have in our backyard. Let's let neighborhood businesses thrive. Let's let small businesses thrive. Let's hire people. And I think we can do it. It's just that we've had leadership that has no vision for our future and, frankly, no faith in the working man and woman in Pennsylvania.
I'm right there with you. Amen. Again, the website, katiemcginty.com. All great stuff. Katie, it was great talking with you. I appreciate the time. Please come back again real soon.
Thanks for what you're doing to get the message out, to get the word out, and to get the real facts out there. You're doing a great job, and it's been my privilege to spend some time with you.
Thanks so much, Katie. Let's take a quick break. Rick, back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
I want to start. When the kids are united, things are gonna be divided. As yesterday, there's a brand new show today.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
There's a growing army of the working poor in our U.S. of A, and big contingents of it are now on the march. They're strategizing, organizing, and mobilizing against the immoral economics of inequality being hung around America's neck by the likes of Walmart, McDonald's, and colleges. Wait a minute. Colleges? You go there to get ahead in life. More education makes you better off, right? Well, ask a college professor about that. You know, the ones who earn PhDs and are now teaching America's next generation. The sorry secret of higher education, from community colleges to brand-name universities, is that they've embraced the corporate culture of a contingent workforce, turning professors into part-time, low-paid, no-benefit, no-tenure, temporary teachers. Overall, more than half of America's higher ed faculty members today are, quote, adjunct professors, meaning they are attached to the school but not essentially a part of it. It also means that these highly educated, fully credentialed professors have become part of America's army of the working poor. They never know until a semester starts whether they'll teach one class, three, or none. Typically, this leaves them with take-home pay somewhere between zero and maybe $1,000 a month. Poverty. Adjuncts usually get no benefits, no real chance of earning full-time positions, no due process or severance pay if dismissed. No say in curriculum or school policies, not even office space. Like their counterparts at Walmart and McDonald's, adjunct college professors are not treated as valuable resources to be nurtured, but as cheap, exploitable, and disposable labor. This is Jim Hightower saying, unsurprisingly, this contingent of the low-wage army is organizing too. For information, contact New Faculty Majority at www.newfacultymajority.info.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
Thank you. The National Labor Relations Act was a New Deal initiative which helped save American capitalism by creating a process which would protect the rights of employees and employers. This was before NAFTA, GATT, and the WTO, which tore legal rights for workers apart, moved millions of jobs out of the U.S. Yes, we stand for the workers at Boeing in Washington State, but we also stand for the workers at Boeing in South Carolina, because they will have no recourse if Boeing wants to move jobs to China. You can't say you want to create jobs here at home while destroying the rights of workers to organize, the right to collective bargaining. These are basic rights in a democratic society. You can't say you want to protect American jobs and not protect American workers. Take away workers' rights to free speech, take away workers' rights to due process, and you create a new class of slave laborers here in the United States who are helpless to stop the movement of jobs out of America. Wait!
Kevin Smith Show. I love that bit of audio. He is so spot on. And, you know, I miss his voice in Congress. But understand, the National Labor Relations Act guarantees every private sector employee in this country the right, again, understand, it is your right to act with other employees to make your conditions better. Better wages, better hours, better conditions, with or without a union. It is absolutely your right to organize. And the employer class likes, well, you know, it's our right to tell you you can't. It's absolutely your right. And what I find interesting, as it was on yesterday, the National Labor Relations Board formally issued a complaint against Walmart. They said that Walmart violated labor laws by threatening and punishing their employees who joined in on the protests, the pro-union protests. The complaint says that that Walmart, who understand it, they hate unions. In fact, in places where there have been union votes, like in Canada, where they organized one of the Walmarts up there, they closed the store. In places around the U.S. where the oil chain center, the auto center had voted to get representation, they closed that. In places where they organized the meat cutters, they got rid of that. Understand, they hate organized labor, and they hate workers who have a voice. Because look, once you have the voice, no more working through your breaks and then having it deducted from your pay. No more of the getting cheated out of overtime. No more of the abuses that have gone on over the years. No more of that. And it comes to light. That's what they don't want. Now, according to the complaint, which involves 60 employees, including 19 who were fired or laid off illegally for taking part in the protests, Walmart, according to the report, said Walmart threatened, disciplined, and or terminated employees for legally joining the protest and engaging in other legally protected activities. The National Labor Relations Act guarantees the rights of private sector employees to act together to try and improve their wages and working conditions with or without a union. Basically what I just said. And, you know, this is why. If you remember going back for the past couple of years, why you had Republicans so worked up, so in a tizzy, that how dare the National Labor Relations Board have any say in what's going on at Boeing, who understand, and this is the reality of it. Boeing said, hey, guess what? We're to the workers in Washington. We're going to move a plant across the country. We're going somewhere else. Unless you take pay cuts. Now, they didn't say it that directly, but we both know. We're moving, taking the jobs with us. Unless, you know, we can work something out. Now, by saying that, and they were quite open about it. It wasn't as direct as I put it, but they were quite open about it. In fact, I talked to the guy who had prepared the case that they were going to take to court. Because legally, and understand, this is the law. Legally, had Boeing been found guilty of what I just said, they could have been forced to close the plant and move it back to Washington. Now, understand, that was never going to happen. Being the law or not, never, ever, ever going to happen. The wealth class in this country would never allow that. But they spent a whole lot of money demonizing the labor board. And, you know, Republicans went ballistic. Every time you'd turn on the radio or TV for a while, man, that's all they were doing. They were attacking the NLRB. A board that I would say the vast majority of the country had never really heard of. And I guess that's an education problem. Because that's where you go back to World War II, and that's where we had industrial peace. You know, you go back to the Depression when this country was being ripped apart from within because capital had so badly screwed this country up. And labor was demanding, hey, we need to feed our kids. And this National Labor Relations Board is where you go, where they decide, so we're going to go get industrial peace. And it's just, I'm glad to see that something's being done. And maybe by having these stories out there, maybe what we're going to do is going to wake some people up and say, hey, you know what, maybe I can do it too. Pretty much that simple. Let's take a quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Time to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get The Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
There's a growing army of the working poor in our U.S. of A., and big contingents of it are now on the march. They're strategizing, organizing, and mobilizing against the immoral economics of inequality being hung around America's neck by the likes of Walmart, McDonald's, and colleges. Wait a minute. Colleges? You go there to get ahead in life. More education makes you better off, right? Well, ask a college professor about that. You know, the ones who earn PhDs and are now teaching America's next generation. The sorry secret of higher education, from community colleges to brand-name universities, is that they've embraced the corporate culture of a contingent workforce, turning professors into part-time, low-paid, no-benefit, no-tenure, temporary teachers. Overall, more than half of America's higher ed faculty members today are, quote, adjunct professors, meaning they are attached to the school but not essentially a part of it. It also means that these highly educated, fully credentialed professors have become part of America's army of the working poor. They never know until a semester starts whether they'll teach one class, three, or none. Typically, this leaves them with take-home pay somewhere between zero and maybe $1,000 a month. Poverty. Adjuncts usually get no benefits, no real chance of earning full-time positions, no due process or severance pay if dismissed, no say in curriculum or school policies, not even office space. Like their counterparts at Walmart and McDonald's, adjunct college professors are not treated as valuable resources to be nurtured, but as cheap, exploitable, and disposable labor. This is Jim Hightower saying, unsurprisingly, this contingent of the low-wage army is organizing too. For information, contact New Faculty Majority at www.newfacultymajority.info.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
Volkswagen just invested in Tennessee, in a right-to-work state, at a low cost, with less health care. Why should we prop others up when other companies can compete in this marketplace? Time to let these people learn the lesson the hard way.
Lower wages, less health care, no benefits. Isn't that the goal? That's the whole goal of this paycheck deception. That's the whole goal of pimping these right-to-work-for-less laws. Yeah. I don't know how much more honest he could have been. That's the goal of the Republican majority. That's what they want. You to work for less. Which in turn then means more for their campaign donors. Pretty much that simple. Interesting bit of history today. Today was the day the 18th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Today was the day it was ratified and became law, the law of the land. Well, what's the 18th Amendment, Rick? That's when they began prohibition, prohibited the manufacture, sale, or transportation of intoxicating liquors for beverage purposes. 9 months from now, back in 1919, Congress would pass the Volstead Act or the National Prohibition Act over the veto of President Woodrow Wilson. Of course, the Volstead Act created the Treasury Department's, squad that went after the bootleggers. And did it stop anything? Did people stop drinking? No. Created a whole nice little network of underground. And in fact, it took a full 24 years before the 21st Amendment came along and repealed prohibition. Now, the other side of this is what you've got now. The conservatives of that day wanted to prohibit it. The conservatives of today, this tells you how bizarre conservatism has gotten. The conservatives of that day, prohibit alcohol. We want to make sure that people are right and studious and not those drunken, falling down fools and not all of those societal costs and abuse and all that stuff. No, we don't. We're going to ban it. We can't have it. It's bad. To now, to today, where Tom Corbett and Mark Terzai and all the Republicans here in the States say, no, we don't want any prohibition whatsoever. We want it everywhere. We want it on every corner, everywhere. Government should have no interest in what happens. It's amazing to me how in less than 100 years, the ideology has completely, completely done a 180 to where we're going to prohibit it to now we want it everywhere. And I think the vast majority of Pennsylvanians don't want it everywhere. I think adults know, hey, if I want my spirit, if I want a little bit of this or that, I know where to get it. And I can make the adult decision of where it is and when to get it. Do you really want hard alcohol as an impulse buy? I don't think people do. What's interesting is, when all this liquor privatization started, the beer distributors were 100% behind it. Until they realize that we, the voters, we, the people of the Commonwealth, actually just want to buy a six-pack at the grocery store. Oops. Let's take a quick break. We're back. If you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast. Stitcher on the smartphone. Right back. It's desperate times, so desperate measures we explore. Marching on the Capitol to lobby leaders for involvement. 3,000 people screaming out. Where's our government? Lawsuits and arraignments. Members under company surveillance. Public divided, either they love us or they hate us. Crossing billions off our back, and it's still not enough. They should have took into account that we never give up. We'll be here one day longer. One day longer. The people's voice is stronger.
Radio experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. United Auto Workers President Bob King told the German newspaper that the UAW will represent workers in the Chattanooga, Tennessee VW plant by June. VW's German workers are unionized, represented by IG Metall. The UAW has urged VW to put a German-style works council in place in Tennessee. Under U.S. labor law, the workers would have to be in a union for the works council to be set up. The UAW says a clear majority of VW workers in Chattanooga want to be represented by the UAW. VW has called for a formal vote by employees and says it will accept the workers' decision. Right-wing anti-union groups, though, are fighting the UAW organizing effort. Republican U.S. Senator Bob Corker has said that if the VW plant is organized by the UAW, it would have a domino effect on other non-union auto plants in the South. UAW President Bob King told KPBS Radio that the union is stressing cooperation with VW in this campaign, and right-wing fears that the union will be bad for business are unfounded.
They get pressured by the right wing of the party. Unfortunately, That's a fear that these politicians have that overcomes common sense. Campaigns that we have going on currently are being run very differently than we've run campaigns in the past.
In addition to VW in Tennessee, the UAW is campaigning to organize BMW, Daimler, and Nissan plants in Alabama, South Carolina, and Mississippi. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says it's appalling that Senate Republicans refusing to extend unemployment benefits with no strings attached. For now, efforts to extend those benefits are stalled in the Senate. Meanwhile, the AFL-CIO says millions of Americans who want work but can't find it are facing more weeks without much-needed benefits. One of them is Dale Jakobiak of Warren, Michigan.
Hardship-wise, I've already pulled $10,000 out of my 401, of which at the end of this month I'll have depleted that and probably have to do that again. You know, what I was getting in the federal benefits was modest, but because I live modest, it was enough to keep the rent paid and, you know, the gas and the electric paid. So, you know, it makes quite a difference.
The AFL-CIO says Congress should stop playing games with jobless benefits or working families should force them out of their jobs in November. The International Association of Machinists could become the first union representing employees at Amazon. A small group of 30 Amazon workers in Delaware are voting on whether or not to join the union. IAM spokesperson John Carr says a union win could lead to other Amazon workers joining the IAM.
A strategic plan would probably come together and we would start looking at what other locations or within the location on how to go forward.
To support Workers Independent News, donate now at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
I will oppose the Columbia Free Trade Agreement.
Now it's time to clear the way for a series of trade agreements.
You can trust me.
From the Monongahela Valley to the Mesabi Iron Range, the coal mines of Appalachia, the story's always the same. 700 tons of metal a day, now sir, you tell me the world's changed. Once I made you rich enough to forgive my name, in Youngstown.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So today, the Senate Finance Committee had a hearing on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And, you know, at the bottom of all this, I don't know what's in it, not allowed to know, evidently. I'm not one of the 600 approved trade advisors, lobbyists, who have the backing of corporate America. And I look at this. I've seen a bunch of these reports, but this trade council, that many of the very large corporations in our country belong to. This industry trade advisory committee, that they're the ones who send a bunch of lobbyists. The money that they've given to politicians, staggering. Just this 18-member organization, nearly $24 million to current members of Congress in the last 10 years. AT&T itself has given more than $8 million to members of Congress. And you go, well, which side is it? Who's to blame? Well, both of them, which is why these agreements seem to have so much support on both sides of the aisle. Kind of makes you wonder which side of the aisle they're on for us, which is why I've asked Mike Dolan, he's a legislative representative for the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, to come talk to us. Mike, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, thanks so much for having me on. I have to say, I mean, you nailed it right there just in your intro just now. I have to, you know, as a lobbyist for the Teamsters on trade policy up on Capitol Hill, day in, day out, Congress in, Congress out, I find that the distinction between Republicans and Democrats, frankly, isn't that helpful. The more helpful distinction when it comes to trade policy, to globalization, is between populists and corporatists.
There you go.
And there's populists and there's corporatists in both parties. Our challenge right now is to pull the populists from both parties together to a sufficient number in the House of Representatives. That number is, as always, 218 of the 435 members of the House to reject the corporate trade, so-called free trade agenda. It's so-called free trade. We know, you know, I know, your listeners know, it's corporate managed trade.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I don't care what ideology we're talking about. Democrat, Republican, green, blue, purple, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Working people get it. We've seen the NAFTA. We've seen all of these insane trade agreements where we keep losing jobs, hemorrhaging jobs, and our standard of living continues to fall. And this, as I'm told, is the mother of all of these and could be one of the very last ones because of the add-on provision that we go through. So, you know, it's not surprising to me, Mike, that they're not doing this in public. And in fact, as the former trade representative Kirk pointed out, Ron Kirk said, you know, if we did it in public, it'd be so unpopular it couldn't become law.
Yeah, there it is. 20 years ago this month, Rick, was when NAFTA was implemented. And we Teamsters, with our brothers and sisters in the other unions and in the other fair trade constituencies in the environmental movement and the family farm and the consumer groups and the faith and based networks, the human rights folks, we've been fighting this for a generation now, this flawed and failed model of NAFTA. And here we are 20 years later, and as you point out, the TPP, this Trans-Pacific Partnership, it's what we call in the biz a docking agreement. It's a docking agreement whereby any other countries that want to get into a free trade deal with the United States, instead of us going back and restarting over and having the debate and having the national conversation, no, they're just going to join this thing, this monstrosity. We haven't seen it yet. It's 29 chapters big. They haven't finished it yet. They've been working on it for the last 3 years in complete secrecy. And I'll tell you, my boss, Jim Hoffa, is as close as you can get to being on the inside, to being next to these negotiations. He's a member of the Labor Advisory Committee. He's on the Advisory Committee for Trade Policy Negotiations, appointed by a senator, President Obama. You know, we're relying on the promises that Senator Obama, as candidate, made about this. We had our hopes pretty high that this is going to be a new kind of trade agreement and a break from the NAFTA model of the last 20 years. But I'm afraid all indications are, Rick, that this is going to be another job killing, outsourcing, environmentally bad trade pact, and the Teamsters are very likely to oppose it. But the hearing that you mentioned in the Senate Finance Committee at the beginning of this segment today, it was a little bit about the TPP, but it was really a lot about the TPA. And I apologize to your listeners. TPP, TPA, that's why it's fast track. And it's a fight we've had before. Fast track trade negotiating authority. That's what this was on, and that's the thing that we got to beat right now, because it's a stalking horse for the trade agreement. But the president, the administration, the USTR, they want this fast track trade negotiating authority in order to ratify the TPP later on, down the road, with no amendments, limited debate, up or down vote in both houses, the same way they got the NAFTA through 20 years ago.
Right. And, I got to be honest. I was against it when H.W. Bush was asking for it. I was against it when Clinton had it. I was against it when W. Bush wanted it. And
yep.
I'm against it now. This is not,
yep,
in my opinion, about a Democrat sitting in the White House or if a Republican were sitting in the White House. This is about Congress doing their job.
Yeah, Article 1. Section 8 of the United States Constitution gives Congress the exclusive authority over the commerce among nations, and that is trade policy. And to pass this fast track right now, for the Congress to do that, to abdicate its constitutional responsibility for this big honker trade agreement with its 29 chapters and its lack of transparency, is, I think, completely inappropriate. After 20 years of NAFTA, after all the secrecy in these negotiations, and with the complexity of this agreement, and the next one coming down the pike, by the way, that's in the pipeline, is the transatlantic.
Right?
There's another one coming down the pike that they're just beginning on the negotiations. Both of those would be grandfathered in to this into this fast-track grant, and it's undemocratic, and it's marginally constitutional. know, and we're going to fight it, and we might just win this fight.
Well, we have
before.
To. It's got to be all of us. You know, it's just not the Teamsters. It's got to be everybody. And, you know, I look at you brought up that there are 29 chapters to it. And as I understand, and look, I'm not allowed to, I haven't been able to see it. In fact, when I asked Alan Grayson about what was in it, he had seen it, but he couldn't tell anybody about it.
Right,
sworn
that's
to
right.
secrecy.
Yeah.
I understand there are only 5 chapters that are actually on issues
yeah.
that have anything to do with trade, you know,
yeah.
like tariffs or any of that stuff. What are the other 24 chapters over?
So, all right, so all kinds of stuff that are outside of the jurisdiction of the Finance Committee or the Ways and Means Committee, which is the other committee of, you know, exclusive technical jurisdiction over trade policy. So you got things like services and investment and of course the intellectual property chapter, very controversial around the patents, you know, state-owned enterprises, government procurement, a bunch of stuff on telecom. So all these different economic sectors, all these different jurisdictions of domestic regulatory policy making that the Congress owns, you know, it's just their stuff.
Right.
And this is the way corporate America comes through the back door, through these trade agreements, to make changes to, right, U.S. Law, to our policy, in their favor, on their corporate investment elite agenda, that is anti-democratic. It's crazy for the Congress, for Congress members, regardless of party label, to be given up their domestic policy jurisdiction, their committee jurisdiction, their constitutional prerogatives, this way through a fast track deal. And that's the argument we're making up on the Hill on both sides of the aisle.
Yeah, I've yet to find anybody who goes, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. Everybody I talk to says, wait a minute, I want vigorous debate. I want to know as much as I can. Fast track's just a bad idea. But what gets me is, you know, a lot of my friends think that Buy American policies are a good idea. Buy Pennsylvania policies
mm-hmm.
are a good idea. And it's my understanding, and correct me if you think I'm wrong, that we pass these agreements, that's over.
Absolutely. No, that's the whole thing about government procurement. I mean, going back to the WTO, I mean, I don't want to get too deep into the weeds on the trade policy stuff, but what you're talking about is government procurement, right?
Yep.
I go back a few years, and I remember how in the anti-apartheid campaigns, some of the states, like Massachusetts and some of the other states, passed these selective purchasing laws that if you want to do business with a state of, you know, Massachusetts, you want to sell us services or goods or anything, you cannot be doing any business with South Africa. And this is part of our selective purchasing, a government procurement sort of mindset that helped us end apartheid.
Right.
Right? And that was before there was a WTO. Remember, this is why we were in Seattle in 99, was exactly on this kind of stuff, to protest that the corporations had taken over our trade policy, and it was no longer around values that we share about human rights or American jobs or environmental sustainability or labor rights and working conditions globally for, you know, our brothers and sisters in the export industries in all these other countries. It became about the corporate agenda. So, you know, they passed the WTO, and then along comes, you know, Burma, right? Myanmar, and those cats took over, and all kinds of terrible human rights oppression and all the rest. And when those same states and jurisdictions tried to pass laws that said basically take out South Africa, put in Myanmar, the country formerly known as Burma, right?
Yep.
It was trade illegal. And that's been the trend, right? And you couldn't do it. And that's been the trend, and it is the trend to this day in this agreement, the TPP, that takes away our opportunity to do not just, Buy American, but a domestic content, all the domestic content rules, living wage rules, recycling, anything that gets in the way of the corporate agenda, in the way of their profits, right, suddenly becomes, you know, a trade barrier, an unfair trade practice. And then we find ourselves in these, not courts, but tribunals, you know, these supranational tribunals and faceless trade bureaucrats making decisions that trump our laws and our judicial process. The whole thing is remarkably anti-democratic, and this is something that obviously strikes a chord across a wide ideological spectrum. Democrats, Republicans, Libertarians, Greens, all of us are outraged.
Well, I mean, you want to keep your sovereignty, and if you pass a law, you want to make sure that that people obey it in your community.
That's right.
And what's frustrating on this is, you know, so much of those tribunals, we never get to really know who it is. They're probably they're corporate attorneys, corporate lobbyists do this stuff. It's like this whole incestuous little ball where where it's not about what's right or wrong. It's about it's about their profits. And you know, I have some conservative friends who were they're afraid that, you know, we're gonna have one world government, and I go, we will if we pass things like this.
Rick, it's, you know, it's an interesting conversation. I mean, I have to say that, it's a deeper conversation. But, you know, I was sitting across the table earlier today, the Longworth House office building, and I was talking to these cats, and one of them was a Tea Party lobbyist, and he was up on the hill talking about the same thing I'm talking about. I'm talking to the Democrats, trying to keep them together, keep them unified in a progressive way against this bad fast-track bill. And here's this other guy. Completely alleged, I mean, if you would think kind of naturally in the linear way that the mainstream media thinks, that this guy's completely on the other end of the ideological spectrum. Well, I mean, he probably doesn't like unions very much, all right? But we realize that we so fundamentally agreed on the basic precepts of sovereignty and the constitutionality and making trade policy work for working families that, you know, we realize maybe this ideological continuum isn't a straight line at all. Nope. Maybe it's a circle, and we just met up at the top.
Or, you know, as I've been saying all along, or the Tea Party isn't as crazy as they think they are.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're just ticked off, and they've been given the red meat by the Wall Street crowd to say, here, it's those people who are really to blame, when it's really the people who are funding them, the Koch brothers and all that sort. Where, you know, because I remember going to those rallies, Mike, and it was there's a lot of union guys who had lost their jobs. They were ticked off about these trade policies. But the sad thing is they blamed their unions for the jobs going overseas.
Right. I've had the same experience, you know, and it's fascinating when you talk to these guys for any length of time, right, and kind of just get past the red meat rhetoric and all the rest, and you can actually get them, I mean, you know, because they're going on about big government, and big government is the problem, gotta get rid of a big government that's in the way, and then it's a small focal shift to get them to understand that it's, in fact, big corporations.
Yep.
That are the problem. And then they make that small focal shift and they go, oh, the big corporations who own the politicians who we blame for the big government, right? It's the big corporations. It's like an epiphany and the scales fall from their eyes and, you know, there's agreement. And there's this amazing kind of like no longer D or R, red or blue. It's populist versus the corporation.
Yeah, I often say, I would rather, look, I'm as distrustful as government as anyone, but I would rather have a government that is accountable to me, where they have to come to me every 2, 4, or 6 years to ask for my vote to continue. I'd rather have that than a corporate boardroom who makes backroom decisions that I never get to know or see or be a part of. It's that simple. Let me ask you a last question I've got for you, Mike Dolan. You know, how do we stop this fast track moving forward? It seems the train is on the tracks. How do we stop it?
Well, you know, we've done it before, all right? And some of your listeners may remember when there was another second-term Democratic president in the White House, fellow name of Bill Clinton, and another different Republican speaker in the speaker's chair. It was a guy named Newt Gingrich, and it was 1997-98, the 105th Congress, and the global goober, Bill Clinton, he wanted to expand NAFTA through a thing called the FTAA, the Free Trade Area of the Americas. And you may remember that fight, but the reason why we don't hear about the FTAA anymore is because that year we beat Fast Track. And we did it even though the Republican speaker and the Democratic second-term president, himself unpopular with much of the Republican caucus at that time, Monica Lewinsky and a lot of stuff was going on in those days, he's very unpopular in much the same way that Barack Obama is unpopular with the Tea Party. And that the Tea Party caucus within the House of Representatives is not controlled effectively by Boehner, whom they dislike almost as much as they dislike the president. And so you take, oh, I don't know, 160, 170 Democrats who are always going to be with us, and you add another 60 Republicans, maybe more, right? And you get past that magic number. And when they realize that we've organized better at the grassroots level, this is where your listeners come in, Rick, then we can actually win this thing the same way we did with a certain a lot of Democrats, most of the Democratic caucus, and some of these other Republicans who are ready to deny Obama and to deny this administration the fast track they think they need to pass the TPP. It's been done before. We can do it again.
I'm right there with you, Mike Dolan. We would love to have you back on the program real soon, because this is going to continue.
Oh, yeah.
Fascinating conversation. I appreciate
it. Thank you. Great, Rick. Thanks a lot for having me.
Thanks so much. Mike Dolan, legislative representative for the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. Quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
We've been talking about our original American Pledge of Allegiance written by Francis Bellamy in 1892. When introduced in October of that year as part of a Columbus Day program, it was well received and spread rapidly. At the urging of Bellamy, a salute was also adopted with the right arm extended toward the flag while reciting the pledge. Though popular, well used, and effective, the pledge and salute were changed 5 times over the next 62 years. The first added the word "to" before the phrase "the republic for which it stands." The next change came in 1923 at the urging of the National Flag Conference, which wanted to replace the words "my flag" to "flag of the United States," so new immigrants wouldn't confuse loyalties. And the words "of America" after "United States" were added in 1924. Join us again as Congress takes control. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
There's a growing army of the working poor in our U.S. of A, and big contingents of it are now on the march. They're strategizing, organizing, and mobilizing against the immoral economics of inequality being hung around America's neck by the likes of Walmart, McDonald's, and colleges. Wait a minute. Colleges? You go there to get ahead in life. More education makes you better off, right? Well, ask a college professor about that. You know, the ones who earn PhDs and are now teaching America's next generation. The sorry secret of higher education, from community colleges to brand-name universities, is that they've embraced the corporate culture of a contingent workforce, turning professors into part-time, low-paid, no-benefit, no-tenure, temporary teachers. Overall, more than half of America's higher ed faculty members today are, quote, adjunct professors, meaning they are attached to the school but not essentially a part of it. It also means that these highly educated, fully credentialed professors have become part of America's army of the working poor. They never know until a semester starts whether they'll teach one class, three, or none. Typically, this leaves them with take-home pay somewhere between zero and maybe $1,000 a month. Poverty. Adjuncts usually get no benefits, no real chance of earning full-time positions, no due process or severance pay if dismissed, no say in curriculum or school policies, not even office space. Like their counterparts at Walmart and McDonald's, adjunct college professors are not treated as valuable resources to be nurtured, but as cheap, exploitable, and disposable labor. This is Jim Hightower saying, unsurprisingly, this contingent of the low-wage army is organizing too. For information, contact New Faculty Majority at www.newfacultymajority.info.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. So the concept of the least restrictive trade barrier, those are trade policies. And what does that mean? Basically, in layman's terms, that's race to the bottom. That's who's willing to slit each other's throats for penny, who's willing to pollute their environment the most, who's willing to exploit their workers. And in fact, you know, there was a study done back in September of 2013 by the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and they found that GDP growth, from what we know of this trade deal, would account for about a 0.1% increase annually. It'd be minuscule. Now, what we've also seen other reports that say 90% of the people working in this country would see their incomes decrease, and you would then see inequality exponentially worsen. And you go, but Rick, I thought GDP was going up. Yes, but here's the thing. It's only going up a very tiny amount. But the share of those that gain, much like since the end of the recession, would end up in the hands of the very few, much like since the end of the recession. You go back and you look at the statistics that since the recession, 95% of all new income has gone to the top 1%. And if you look at the 3 years following, that number was 121%. It's something we got to think about. And what gets me is this whole fast track thing. The other day I saw a tweet from John Boehner, who said, you know, in response to President Obama saying that he would use executive orders to get things done, Boehner said, well, we use the Constitution to get things done. How about, Mr. I love the Constitution, how about you do your constitutional duty? Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution states quite emphatically, the Congress shall have power to regulate commerce with foreign nations. Why would you want to abdicate that responsibility? We give fast-track authority. Whoever's sitting in the White House gets to decide who's in it, gets to decide what's in it. And allows the president to unilaterally sign these agreements before Congress really even votes on them. NAFTA was 1,700 pages. So for all of the right-wing crazies, come with us, because you know you want to. The reality is we've had hundreds of trade agreements in this country, hundreds of them throughout the years, without fast track. And you know, before we had fast track, when those hundreds of agreements had to be hammered out, we did pretty well. Did pretty well. Only 16 trade agreements have been pushed through with fast track authority. And you gotta go, okay, well, we had that whole bit of history where we did fairly well. In fact, trade wise, before 1913, that's kind of, or actually before the Civil War, we funded our entire government off of tariffs. And then after that, a large percentage came from tariffs. And then we went and said, oh, we can't have any tariffs. We need free trade. Which caused a global crisis. But filled the pockets of the robber barons. And now we've got these last 16 that needed fast track authority. Because look, we don't want it. We want good, decent, fair trade agreements. Fair trade. Not free. So when you call your representatives, and I suggest that you do, say, you know what? Do your job. It's that simple. Do your job. Don't abdicate it to someone else. Do your job. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. Well, working people come to talk.
Union man, brother firefighters, my friend. And the kids locked in the Capitol are fighting till the end. And we're not gonna break tonight, and we're not gonna bend. Some say the union's down, but I asked around, and everybody said, this is a union town, a union town, all down the line. This is a union town, all down the line. And if they come to strip our rights away, we'll give them hell every time. This is a union town, all down the line.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. United Auto Workers President Bob King told the German newspaper that the UAW will represent workers in the Chattanooga, Tennessee VW plant by June. VW's German workers are unionized, represented by IG Metall. The UAW has urged VW to put a German-style works council in place in Tennessee. Under U.S. labor law, the workers would have to be in a union for the works council to be set up. The UAW says a clear majority of VW workers in Chattanooga want to be represented by the UAW. VW has called for a formal vote by employees and says it will accept the workers' decision. Right-wing anti-union groups, though, are fighting the UAW organizing effort. Republican U.S. Senator Bob Corker has said that if the VW plant is organized by the UAW, it would have a domino effect on other non-union auto plants in the South. UAW President Bob King told KPBS Radio that the union is stressing cooperation with VW in this campaign, and right-wing fears that the union will be bad for business are unfounded.
They get pressured by the right wing of the party. Unfortunately, that's a fear that these politicians have that overcomes common sense. Campaigns that we have going on currently are being run very differently than we've run campaigns in the past.
In addition to VW in Tennessee, the UAW is campaigning to organize BMW, Daimler, and Nissan plants in Alabama, South Carolina, and Mississippi. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says it's appalling that Senate Republicans are refusing to extend unemployment benefits with no strings attached. For now, efforts to extend those benefits are stalled in the Senate. Meanwhile, the AFL-CIO says millions of Americans who want work but can't find it are facing more weeks without much-needed benefits. One of them is Dale Jakoviak of Warren, Michigan.
Hardship-wise, I've already pulled $10,000 out of my 401, of which at the end of this month I'll have depleted that and probably have to do that again. You know, what I was getting in the federal benefits was modest, but because I live modest, it was enough to keep the rent paid and the gas and the electric paid. So, it makes quite a difference.
The AFL-CIO says Congress should stop playing games with jobless benefits, or working families should force them out of their jobs in November. The International Association of Machinists could become the first union representing employees at Amazon. A small group of 30 Amazon workers in Delaware are voting on whether or not to join the union. IAM spokesperson John Carr says a union win could lead to other Amazon workers joining the IAM.
A strategic plan would probably come together, and we would start looking at what other locations or within the location on how to go forward.
To support Workers Independent News, donate now at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
One of the objectives we have over the next couple months is to help folks understand some of the circumstances that lead folks to a life of poverty. It could just be one bad decision or one unfortunate circumstance that spirals to a life of poverty. And we hope to examine what those decisions are, what barriers are keeping folks in poverty, and helping to eliminate some of those barriers in the future for individuals and families across the state.
I like that quote. I like the quote by the chairman of the Republican Policy Committee here in Pennsylvania, who for a while played poor. They did that hour-long poverty game where they you saw all the smiles and we're poor, yay. One bad decision. I'm fixated on that language. You just made one bad decision, like being born. One bad decision. You pick door number three, the wrong one. And, to me, I was hopeful over the summer when Chairman Reid was running around the state saying, we're going to study this stuff, that there would actually be some policy that would come out to help alleviate poverty. But nothing but what I suggested. More finger pointing, more looking down at the nose, and more demonizing the poor and downtrodden in our society. A new study out by the folks at United for a Fair Economy, State of the Dream 2014, Healthcare for Whom? Enduring Racial Disparities. It is their 11th annual Martin Luther King Jr. Day report, and I've got Brian Miller here. He is the executive director over there. Brian, thanks for taking time for me.
Glad to be on the show, Rick, and glad to be here talking about this report.
I look at this, and having myself grown up in a housing project in and poverty here in the U.S. This is an issue that is extremely important to me because firsthand I saw the disparities in education, in transportation, and opportunities. So when I see something like this, I go, you know, we got to talk about it. So what were your reports? What were the findings?
Well, I think, you know, this report really focused in on the health care issues, but it really looks at two sides of health care. On one, it looks at health outcomes, meaning, you know, shorter lifespans, higher instances of asthma and various diseases, which are driven by the effects of concentrated poverty in large part. But it also looks at health insurance, or the lack thereof, particularly among lower and middle income households, and how the GOP assault on Obamacare is actually making matters significantly worse, particularly the 25-state assault that they've done on the health care issue, expanding of the Medicaid program. That's the core of this report. But I think I want to take back to what you started with as far as that, you know, growing up the projects and what does MLK Day mean in the origins of this report, which is, you know, those who know the history know that Dr. King made a significant transition once the civil rights victories were won. There's a great quote, you know, what does it profit a man to be able to eat at an integrated lunch counter if he doesn't earn enough money to buy a cup of coffee and a hamburger?
Right.
And he turned his attention to economic justice and a broad-based campaign for jobs and health care and broad-based economic justice. And so with this report, this annual report, we really want to carry on that fight.
You know, cause what we hear, though, is, you know, with the election of President Obama, that, and I remember the rhetoric, especially from the far right in this country, that all of these racial issues, they're all dead. Because, see, we're now colorblind. We have a black guy in the White House. Yet, you know, you look at the income disparity, you look at this massive gulf between the haves and the have-nots, and most of the have-nots seem to be the people of color.
Yeah, we absolutely have. I think one of the things is, you know, we have this civil rights victory, and this is an important narrative for us to talk about on the left, in unions, communities, and in communities where we talk about how do we rebuild the kind of broad-based prosperity we had in the post-war period, right? You know, we have the FHA loan, we have the GI bills and strong unions and all these things that gave us the middle class, which was a white middle class because there was a lot of other barriers to people of color participating.
Right.
Including the laws themselves in many cases. But we allowed, you know, once those civil rights victories took place and people of color began to gain access to those same benefits, we allowed people like Reagan and others to demonize those public benefits and to start demonizing government and turn to us against the very programs that would help us all.
And that's important to remember because, you know, I remember the Reagan years, the welfare queen, you know, she's driving around in the Cadillac, eating steak, drinking Dom while you're losing your job and it's their fault. And all of this division and divisiveness. And you know, we're still seeing it today to a much grander direction. But it all comes back down to that, keeping us pitted against one another, which they do very, very well.
Yeah, they do really well. And again, they were able to use the race card. One of the things we talk about in this report, and I think it's important anytime, you know, we're doing this kind of work to really remember our history and how things got the way they were. And so the report has an introductory piece which really looks at that history. It looks at the Southern strategy which was engaged to really form a radical realignment of our nation's political system following the civil rights victories. Which ultimately led to the election of Reagan and Bush and you know, watered down Democrats after that and so forth, and a massive, basically a 30-year march against the kind of policies that give working people access a reasonable share in the wealth their labor produces. And that's an important part of the story that we need to talk about. But, you know, going back to the issue of race, you know, and race is still very important. We are not a post-racial society. You know, when we look at the health side of this report, you know, we look at the fact that, you know, we integrated the lunch counters, but we never asked who owns that lunch counter and why. You know, we never did the kind of what Dr. King called a radical redistribution of economic power. We never did that. And so as a result, 50 years later, or 30 years later, or 50 years later, rather, sorry, you know, black and Latinos households hold only 13 cents of net wealth for every dollar the white households hold. Black and Latino families earn 64 and 63 cents every dollar the white families earn. And there's vast unemployment disparities. Even when you hold things like education constant, even if you just look at college graduates, black college graduates versus white college graduates and so on, you've got 6.3% of blacks unemployed, 5.1% of Latinos, 3.7% of whites. So we have these huge racial disparities that are still very much with us. And you couple that with continued racial segregation, what you get is you get people of color disproportionately pushed into communities of concentrated poverty where they're exposed to higher levels of lead, industrial facilities, waste plants located near them, where you've got lack of access to health care facilities, full-service grocery stores, and a myriad of stressors that just really erode, you know, it essentially forms like a toxic soup,
right,
that cuts people's lives literally short.
No, I remember seeing it firsthand as a kid. I mean, we weren't on the, you know, I grew up in a predominantly black neighborhood. We used to play this neat game called Chase the White Kid and beat him up. But, you know, I remember we were off the bus line. There were no grocery stores within walking distance. Now, this is back in the 70s. I can't imagine how bad things have gotten since that period forward because, you know, it's one of those things that I remember as a kid growing up where there was really no opportunity around us for people to get out of that poverty. And I've always taken the position, Brian, that it's poverty. It's I try to stay away from the white black. It's to me, it's green. The fact that the economic opportunity just isn't there for too many people.
Yeah, and there's certainly a whole lot of that going on. And I think what's happened is that what race is involved. And race is involved in this, and as you said, it's been a way to divide people. It's been a way when, you know, once upon a time when white people were getting access to GI bills and all these things, it was fine. No one raised to think about it. But once people of color began to gain access to a lot of these public investments, we as a society turned against government, suddenly viewed government in a very different light. And so I think to come to terms in order to rebuild the kind of prosperity we need to build in this country, in order to rebuild those structures, the strong unions and other things, we need to get over race in this country, get over racism and the way it is used and recognize that when a person of color gets unemployment, that's just as legitimate as anyone else getting unemployment. The plant closed. It was not their fault.
No, I'm absolutely with you. And you know, what's interesting to me is, you look at the states that are pushing back against Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act, the ones who are refusing to expand Medicaid, the leadership in those states, and you can't help but look at them with kind of a jaundiced eye that this is racially motivated.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and if you look at the way it plays out, it's almost the entire South, with the exception of Arkansas, and a bunch of northern mountain states up towards the north of Dakotas, Montana, and whatnot. And the impacts of this, particularly across the South, because the Dakotas are important, but the reality is those are such sparsely populated states that they don't impact the big picture.
Right.
What's really driving the disparate impacts is that Southern states from Texas all the way over to Florida that are basically refusing to expand Medicaid. And you've got 25 states refusing to expand the Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. All but three of those are headed by Republican governors. And the end result of this is that 5 million people who would have otherwise been insured will now go without health care. And those are not disproportionate, they're majority people of color. African Americans make up only 13% of the country's population, but they are 27% of the people who are going to lose health care because of this 25-state coverage gap. Latinos are 13% of the population. 15% of the population, but they're 21% of the people who are going to lose health care that they would have otherwise got because of the GOP's new 25-state coverage gap. And if you look at that, the way that plays out, you know, the South, you've got the entire South where large portions of African Americans live, starting from Virginia all the way over to Louisiana and Arkansas. And when it comes to the Latino community, you know, you've got really the drivers are Texas and Florida. You know, you've got Texas, over of the 5 million people who are going to go without health care, 1 million of them live in Texas.
Wow.
A state that's 38% Latino.
But the thing that gets
very
me is
conservative southern states that are just sticking it to the poor folks and the people of color in their state.
But here's the thing that gets me. I mean, you're not even to half of the population who will not be covered by this insurance. What about the other half? I mean, you know, you look at this, and how can you, with a straight face, as a governor, say that I'm not going to extend this health insurance, this security to all people, even if your mindset is based on race? Still, over half of aren't of people of color.
Yeah, you know, there's a great quote by a woman from, I think it was Alabama or Mississippi, it was one of these papers, and she talks about the enormous length to which people would you know, go to deny health care to people of color. It's like this perception of people's heads, oh, my goodness, a person of color is going to benefit. This is somehow an awful idea now. It somehow diminishes the value of this program. Meanwhile, there's a lot of white folks who would also benefit from it, and they lose out. We all lose out. It's a lose-lose when we do this. And there's one of the things we have Reverend Barber, William Barber in
North Carolina, right.
Yeah, he wrote the foreword for our report. And he has a really great line, which I think is worth reading here, that he wrote, you know, and finally, the problem is political. The greatest myth of our time is the notion that extreme policies harm a small subset of people, such as people of color. However, these policies harm all of us. What we've seen in North Carolina and other parts of the country are wealthy extremists playing on the fears of working class and white people. We've seen ultra-conservative politicians adopting a divide-and-conquer strategy, causing many people to vote against their own self-interest. Our job is to unpack the truth of these extreme policies and how they adversely impact all. And that's really what we strive to do in this report. And I should also say, faireconomy.org/dream. You can download the report, read it. It's got some really good history. It's got some really good analysis of the health care debate, including the assault on the Affordable Care Act. It also has some good workshops at the end that people can use to stimulate conversation at the local union hall or church group or whatever.
Right. We'll make sure we get a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Brian Miller's name. It'll take you right there. You know, are there any states that are doing well at closing this gap? Are there any examples of places that, you know, examples of things that maybe we should be pursuing? You know, because the states are supposed to be laboratories of innovation. Are any states doing well?
Absolutely. You got to talk about Vermont. You know, it's an exception. It's an anomaly. It's this interesting little state up north, but they have taken the freedom that the ACA gives and took it they basically took what the Affordable Care Act instructions say, design a healthcare system that meets these criteria. Well, they met that criteria and then some, which is that they're going to become, as of 2017, they're going to be the first state in the nation with a single-payer universal healthcare system, funded in large part through the Affordable Care Act, but also with local tax revenue.
Right.
And so on.
That's fantastic.
And it's pretty groundbreaking. And, you know, on one hand, in this report, we want to hammer those 25 governors who are rejecting Medicaid expansion. But on the other hand, we want to raise the bar in the other 25 states. Said, look, you've taken the Medicare expansion. That's great. Let's talk about taking it a little further. Let's look at Vermont, because that's where the country ultimately needs to go.
I'm right there with you. And one of the 25 governors who has not taken it is right here in our state, Governor Tom Corbett, one of those. And again, there's a big part of me that thinks it's the party infrastructure. You see all of this veiled racial speak, and I think a big part of it has to do with that racial question.
Yeah, it does. You know, it does. It's the way in it plays out. I mean, race is obviously intertwined with all of this, and we really try to get at the bottom of that in the report. I think in the case of healthcare, you know, one of the things that we talk about in the report, and this goes to this sort of building the case for single payer, right, is that, you know, if you think of employer-based healthcare, well, if you look at it, one can could make an argument that, well, there's nothing inherently racist about that. There's nothing by design that would do, that would create racial outcomes. But because it's built on top of another system, the employment sector, where we know there's racial disparities, where we know people with, you know, black sound names are going to have their resumes shuffled to the bottom of the stack, we know people of color are less likely to get the managerial positions, and so forth, and what you end up with is a system where people of color are more likely to work low-wage jobs, minimum-wage jobs, part-time work, temporary work, all of which are less likely to provide health insurance. So the end result of this is that you've got much higher rates of I think it's 29% of Latinos lack health insurance, 19% of blacks, and 11% of whites. And obviously, all of us are lacking health care, and that's a problem.
I'm with you.
In any program that closes that gap is going to, by definition, disproportionately provide more benefit to people of color than anyone else because they're the most excluded, you know. And any time you have a policy that does that, all of a sudden people, you know, their hairs go up, politicians, you know, they get bent out of shape. Oh, God, it's going to become a bunch of benefits to these people. But the reality is that we have historical racism that's created huge inequalities in this country. Any program that moves towards universal anything is going to provide more benefits to communities of color because those communities of color are further behind.
But it's going to also give benefits to everyone and make sure that there's a line in the sand that none of us can fall through.
Absolutely.
And that's where I think that people have to realize that, you know, while someone else may benefit, so will you. And, of course, the report is State of the Dream 2014, asking the question, health care for whom? We've got a link at therichsmithshow.com. Just click on Brian Miller's name. It'll take you right there. He's executive director of United for a Fair Economy. If you want to check out their website, faireconomy.org. Brian, it was great talking with you. I appreciate the time.
All right, Rick, always glad to be on the program.
Thanks so much. Let's take a quick break. Right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at therichsmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
There's a growing army of the working poor in our U.S. of A., and big contingents of it are now on the march. They're strategizing, organizing, and mobilizing against the immoral economics of inequality being hung around America's neck by the likes of Walmart, McDonald's, and colleges. Wait a minute. Colleges? You go there to get ahead in life. More education makes you better off, right? Well, ask a college professor about that. You know, the ones who earn PhDs and are now teaching America's next generation. The sorry secret of higher education, from community colleges to brand-name universities, is that they've embraced the corporate culture of a contingent workforce, turning professors into part-time, low-paid, no-benefit, no-tenure, temporary teachers. Overall, more than half of America's higher ed faculty members today are, quote, adjunct professors, meaning they are attached to the school but not essentially a part of it. It also means that these highly educated, fully credentialed professors have become part of America's army of the working poor. They never know until a semester starts whether they'll teach one class, three, or none. Typically, this leaves them with take-home pay somewhere between zero and maybe $1,000 a month. Poverty. Adjuncts usually get no benefits, no real chance of earning full-time positions, no due process or severance pay if dismissed. No say in curriculum or school policies, not even office space. Like their counterparts at Walmart and McDonald's, adjunct college professors are not treated as valuable resources to be nurtured, but as cheap, exploitable, and disposable labor. This is Jim Hightower saying, unsurprisingly, this contingent of the low-wage army is organizing too. For information, contact New Faculty Majority at www.newfacultymajority.info. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
Something is happening in our world. The masses of people are rising up, and wherever they are assembled today, whether they are in Johannesburg, South Africa, Nairobi, Kenya, Accra, Ghana, New York City, Atlanta, Georgia, Jackson, Mississippi, or Memphis, Tennessee, the cry is always the same. We want to be free.
Call out the Coast Guard, send up the flare. The iceberg's coming, no one cares. So we'll go down to the company town.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. So to highlight exactly what Brian Miller was talking about, you look at Tennessee, where you've got a couple of Republicans, a guy named May Beaver, or a woman named May Beavers, and a guy named Mark Potty. His actual name is Potty. I'm sorry, that's not funny. They both announced legislation that would prevent the state from cooperating in any way with the Affordable Care Act, in any way. In fact, this bill that they've introduced may force hospitals to verify and ban any patient who has insurance through the Affordable Care Act, through healthcare.gov. You think about the cumbersome bureaucracy that the hospitals would have to expand to say, do you have Obamacare? Sorry, you're going to die. Now, you got to wonder what's going to happen to the 36,000 folks in Tennessee who've already purchased their health insurance from the exchange, from the federal exchange, because Tennessee, like Pennsylvania, not a state that set up their exchanges, which has always made me kind of wonder. These are the people who say, we don't want the federal government doing anything for us. Yet the federal exchange is what they ended up with. You figure it out. I can't. Now, the other problem with this could be the Medicaid program in Tennessee, or what they call 10Care. 10Care actually uses the healthcare.gov website. So you kind of got to wonder what's going to happen to that program. And, again, you know, in talking with Brian Miller there from United for a Fair Economy, you kind of look at these states now with a kind of a corner of the eye going, is that the point? Is the point, let's see which folks we can stick it to? And is that really what's behind it? Now, understand, from the very beginning, you heard the voices. You heard the Rush Limbaughs and the Mitch McConnells. I want him to fail. He's going to be a one-term president. And then you heard he's a black guy. You know, he might not be all that bright. Institutional racism. How can you deny it? Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, thericksmithshow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. Stitcher on the smartphone. Quick break, right back with Hour 3. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. United Auto Workers President Bob King told the German newspaper that the UAW will represent workers in the Chattanooga, Tennessee VW plant by June. VW's German workers are unionized, represented by IG Metall. The UAW has urged VW to put a German-style works council in place in Tennessee. Under U.S. labor law, the workers would have to be in a union for the works council to be set up.
UAW says a clear majority of VW workers in Chattanooga want to be represented by the UAW. VW has called for a formal vote by employees and says it will accept the workers' decision. Right-wing anti-union groups, though, are fighting the UAW organizing effort. Republican U.S. Senator Bob Corker has said that if the VW plant is organized by the UAW, it would have a domino effect on other non-union auto plants in the South. UAW President Bob King told KPBS Radio that the union is stressing cooperation with VW in this campaign, and right-wing fears that the union will be bad for business are unfounded.
They get pressured by the right wing of the party. Unfortunately, that's a fear that these politicians have that overcomes common sense. Campaigns that we have going on currently are being run very differently than we've run campaigns in the past.
In addition to VW in Tennessee, the UAW is campaigning to organize BMW, Daimler, and Nissan plants in Alabama, South Carolina, and Mississippi. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says it's appalling that Senate Republicans are refusing to extend unemployment benefits with no strings attached. For now, efforts to extend those benefits are stalled in the Senate. Meanwhile, the AFL-CIO says millions of Americans who want work but can't find it are facing more weeks without much-needed benefits. One of them is Dale Jakowiak of Warren, Michigan.
Hardship-wise, I've already pulled $10,000 out of my 401, of which at the end of this month I'll have depleted that and probably have to do that again. You know, what I was getting in the federal benefits was modest, but because I live modest, it was enough to keep the rent paid and, you know, the gas and the electric paid. So, you know, it makes quite a difference.
The AFL-CIO says Congress should stop playing games with jobless benefits, or working families should force them out of their jobs in November. The International Association of Machinists could become the first union representing employees at Amazon. A small group of 30 Amazon workers in Delaware are voting on whether or not to join the union. IAM spokesperson John Carr says a union win could lead to other Amazon workers joining the IAM.
A strategic plan would probably come together and we would start looking at what other locations or within the location on how to go forward.
To support Workers Independent News, donate now at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. So, you know, I go back to the statement by John Boehner, Speaker of the House, who says, yeah, you know what, we got enough regulations on the books. Got too many already. And pointing the finger at the White House saying, well, they didn't inspect it. In fact, the facility in West Virginia had not been inspected since 1991. And look, you have to point the finger at somebody at the state level for sure, and also at the federal level. But if you remember, you know, me talking about our tour over the summer, our labor history tour, where we went into West Texas, where they had that huge fertilizer explosion, blew a hole 10 feet deep, 93 foot around into the earth, because they hadn't inspected this place since 1985, tells me we've got some serious problems. So I've been asking the question since this bill, is anyone taking a look at what's going on in our backyard? How many of those gated facilities are in our backyard? How many of those places are holding who knows what? And what's it mean to our air? What's it mean to our water? What's it mean to our health? Well, as I talked about last night, there was a piece over at Penn Live written by Bill Helpful. He's with Public Source, about just that question. The title of the article, 1.5 million Pennsylvanians live close to large amounts of hazardous ammonia. And I've got Bill on the line right now to talk to us a little bit about this. Bill, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
You know, I look at this and I ask the question, you know, you see these facilities all around us. You know, what's in these things? Do we have a right to know? And you went around and looked at ammonia as just one thing. What'd you find?
That's correct. And I would put the emphasis on just one of many extremely hazardous chemicals that are regulated. And the reason we looked at ammonia was because of the West Texas explosion. That piqued our curiosity. We want to know what was around here. And First of all, in West Texas, the chemical that was implicated, it's not exactly the one we looked at. It's ammonium nitrate.
Right.
The state is required by federal law to gather information on chemicals like that, and they are required to disclose that information. So we asked for it, and the state of Pennsylvania refused to give it to us. We actually have an appeal going now in Commonwealth Court. We're still trying to get that.
I thought that was supposed to be, you know, as part of our right to know as citizens, something that had to be right there as just basic disclosure law, right?
Well, there's actually a specific federal law that was passed with the Clean Air Act saying that this information it should be made available to the public. And it's a very, very strong law. It requires the states to gather the information. And it requires disclosure. And one of the things that we noticed, Associated Press and Reuters did a survey after West Texas asking how much of this stuff is out there. And about half the states refused to turn that information over, and Pennsylvania was one of them.
Is it because they don't know, or they haven't been tracking it? Because, you know, as you know, on the federal level as well as on the state level, we have seen the starving of regulatory bodies and the starving of agencies that are supposed to be overseeing this stuff. So could it be that, you know, the starvation of these organizations, these operations, has just made it to where the information isn't there?
I think the information in that particular case is there. There are overlapping regulations and overlapping databases. That's part of the problem. It's very difficult to get a comprehensive picture of what's going on. In the West Texas case, the ammonium nitrate is considered a Tier 2 hazardous chemical. And basically, that's just regulatory talk, but that's the regulation that requires states to gather the information and to disclose it to the public. Anhydrous ammonia, which is an ingredient in fertilizer that exploded, is not covered by that law. So that's a whole different a database that we had to find. But in the case of Pennsylvania, they do collect the information. They say they have it. They tell us there's I think they said 8,000 to 10,000 facilities for which they have information, but they don't want to give it to us because their fear is that that would help terror, that getting this information out in the public would help terror.
That's really very ludicrous, because I got to be honest, I stood on the ground in West Texas where that explosion happened. No terrorist did that. That was a corporation not following the rules, exceeding their ability, and in that place, I saw this 93-foot around hole, 10-foot deep. But moreover, I saw a nursing home with the roof blown out of it and the windows all blown out, a school with the doors practically blown out, all the windows gone, hundreds of homes off their foundation, just gutted. To me, if you're worried about terrorist attack, what's the difference between Al-Qaeda doing it and, well, the West Fertilizer Company that really destroyed that community?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't want to dismiss the fear of terrorism, but I agree with you that the greater risk is by the public and the emergency responders not knowing what's there. And that's what happened in West Texas. 15 people were killed. Most of them were first responders. Many of the first responders knew that they had anhydrous ammonia there. They did not know that they had ammonium nitrate.
Right.
And that's the stuff that exploded.
Yep.
They basically went in and they did the wrong thing because they were not prepared, and that should not be allowed to happen.
No, absolutely should not. And so you got to ask the question of how many of these facilities have these safety plans in place to where if there is an emergency and those first responders, you know, since 9/11, we've been putting firefighters on this pedestal of heroes. And look, these are some great folks, but we're sending them in without the knowledge of how they protect themselves first, let alone us.
Yeah, and I think in most cases the companies do have plans and they do work with their local emergency committees and first responders. I worry about the outliers,
yep.
The smaller companies in many cases that don't have the resources. The companies that are economically challenged because of our economy, and they're cutting corners. They're not doing preventative maintenance. They're not training their employees. They're cutting employees who know how to deal with this stuff. That's what I worry about. Most companies, I mean, they understand the risk. This is their business, and you know, they work there. They're the first ones who are going to be hit by the explosion or the leak. So they have a lot of incentives to get this right. You look at BP with the Gulf Oil blowout. The BP lost a ton of money. Now, obviously, they weren't doing the right thing ahead of time,
right,
from the start, but and there were some regulatory oversight issues there. I think the bigger companies understand the hazard and the risk, and they want to do it right.
You know, for me, I look at this, and again, it comes back down to you have regulations in place so that there's a floor and that everyone has to follow it, and that you inspect everyone at a certain point. And you look at our regulatory bodies, OSHA, for instance. You know, I saw a statistic not too long ago for OSHA to inspect every workplace in this country. It'd be 111 years. And you start going, you know, at what point do we start thinking, again, that we need to be making sure that the outliers, the bad actors, are identified, and we make sure that everyone, you know, stays at least a minimum standard.
Right, I agree. I think the regulatory agencies are undermanned, and basically they're dependent on the companies to do the right thing. And again, I believe that most of the companies are doing the right thing, it's starting to look like in West Virginia perhaps there wasn't as much attention given as needed to be given.
No, in fact,
what really bothers me in that one is so far it looks like we don't even know much about the chemical. You know, what is this chemical? What does it do? What are the short-term effects? What are the chronic effects of this chemical? That's kind of scary.
That's extremely scary. And the sad reality is there are tens of thousands of chemicals out there that, you know, as someone who drove a truck for a living, they lump things into different categories, and you don't actually know exactly what that chemical is. Oh, it's sort of like this. All of them have different brand names, but they're lumped into first responder categories where you don't really know what that chemical is because there's so many of them.
Yeah, and the story that I wrote is just about the fixed facility. You've already alluded to the trucks, the trains, the barges that are carrying this stuff around. I talked with one university expert. He was saying that there have been cases where the trucks have been sidelined or rail cars have been sidelined for a while. Months have gone by. In one case, they discovered the rail car when there was an ammonia leak.
Yeah,
and it had been there for months. There's a lot of potential out there for bad situations.
Yeah, I mean, you want to talk about worrying about a terrorist attack. I mean, you look at what's on a lot of our trains, the chlorine gas, the ammonium, a lot of these different things that, you know, could wreak serious havoc.
Yeah, I mean, I think we should point out that in the United States, we have not had the kind of major catastrophe that spurred these regulations to begin with. The catastrophe in Bhopal, India, I think it was 1984, killed 2,000 people overnight.
Yeah.
10,000 people within a couple of weeks. 200,000 people injured. That's what led to these tougher regulations.
And it's in my view, Bill, it's because of the regulations. And the absence, and we hear a lot of people say we need to deregulate. In the absence of regulation, I don't know that we wouldn't see those kind of things.
Well, yeah, I don't know either. In the past year in China, there have been several major ammonia leaks. I think the deaths range from a dozen to over 100 in the three incidents. You know, from what I read, and I don't know this firsthand, but from what I read, the regulation is kind of like China.
Right.
So I think that's the usual scale of these kind of accidents where you don't have regulation. In this country, when you have an ammonia accident, it tends to what usually happens is people are overcome by it, they're hospitalized, and then they get out. They have respiratory irritation, or they have some minor burns.
Right. Or as you pointed out, you know, from 1996 to 2011, you said in your article there were more than 900 ammonia accidents that killed 19 people and injured more than 1,600.
That's right. That's right. And when you look at the you calculate you know, well, how many facilities that involved, that works out to about one of every 15 ammonia facilities over a 15-year period. I don't think that's a record to be proud of, but it's certainly not a Bhopal, India kind of situation, and it's not as bad as what seems to be happening in China.
Right.
The accident rate in Pennsylvania actually is a little bit higher. It's, the facilities over a 15-year period have had about a 10% rate. So one in every 10 facilities had an accident. Again, that doesn't necessarily mean a fatality. In fact, there have been no fatalities in that period in Pennsylvania, and there were 27 injuries.
Right.
I think we need to have some perspective here on the danger, but the potential is always there. And you know, as I said, I worry about the outliers. I worry about economic stress on companies where they cut back. And there are a lot of people who live close to these facilities who don't even know what's there.
And that's the thing that gets me, Bill, is, you know, there are, we don't know what they're storing. And, you know, I hear this argument all the time, especially from my very conservative friends who say, well, it's their property rights. They have the right to do what they want to do on their property. And my belief has always been, to an extent, you go back to Supreme Court Justice Black, who said, you have the right to swing your fists around, until it touches the tip of my nose. And yeah, you have the right to do on your property what it is you want to do until it screws up my water, my air, or affects my health.
Well, I was going to just say that I would argue that the air and the water and the ground, that's a public common. You know, we all have a stake in that. And the when there's a leak or when there's an explosion, it doesn't respect the fence line. You know, the pollution, toxic cloud, explosion, the shockwave, it's going to go where it goes.
Right. So, you know, you just looked at this one chemical, and you know, I keep asking, you know, what else is out there? Here in Pennsylvania, what kind of disclosure, let's say you wanted to know what that big building across the street that's got the big fence around it, what they're doing, is there any way for the public to get that information? Is there any idea, any way to find out what they're storing, what's going on there?
Yes and no. there's a lot of different thresholds involved. There's overlapping databases. We use something called the RTK network to find facilities. And in the case of this story, we were looking at risk management plans. And the risk management plans, they have to have a certain poundage of chemicals. For ammonia, they have to have at least 5 tons. So there are lots of facilities out there that have less than 5 tons. They're not regulated under that rule.
Okay.
So in the case of ammonia, it turns out that there are 122 facilities. Now about those facilities, you have to go to an EPA office or to a government reading room operated by the Department of Justice. And then you're restricted on what you can see. You're not allowed to make photocopies. You can't bring any electronics in. The EPA sends the reports to that office, you know, to that reading room, and you can see no more than 10 per month. Now, there's an exception. You can see every facility in your area, and they define that by there's another federal rule about who regulates hazmat in your area. So in Pennsylvania, that would be on the county level. So you could see every risk management profile for your county, or you can see 10 per month for anywhere.
Okay.
in the state or the country. Well, there's 122 facilities. If one person was doing that, it would take you more than a year.
Right.
And if you were looking at every chemical that is regulated under that program, it would take you more than 3 years. So it's hard to get that information.
Yeah, and they put those obstacles up, I think, on purpose. But you mentioned there's a threshold. And if I remember right, didn't West Texas, didn't that fertilizer plant, Weren't they supposed to have, I forget what the number was, the amount that they were allowed to have, and they had like something like three or four times that amount. So the question I keep asking, as you point out, the outliers, are there those companies here where, that threshold is there, they're reporting they're not there, but possibly they could be?
Well, we don't know. We took a top-down look, and we're basing our findings on what the companies themselves reported. It's always possible that there's a company out there that's over the threshold that's not reporting. There's also the possibility of a company that claims that is over the threshold and is reporting but isn't really doing it. That was the example in the story about Hershey Creamery, where they had a risk management plan, but they didn't have a risk management plan. They certified that they have one, but they didn't really inspect. They didn't have an evacuation plan. They didn't do the training. And they got caught. It was actually the first case nationally where the company was prosecuted. This was a criminal prosecution for not filing a legitimate risk management plan. And they since have done it. I mean, they've inspected and they're up to snuff now. But for several years, they were claiming that they had a plan when, in fact, there really wasn't a plan.
Wow. So let's leave this on a positive note because, I don't want people running for the exits thinking, oh, my God, there's going to be ammonium nitrate and anhydrous ammonia everywhere because Rick said you can handle this stuff safely. This is stuff that can be stored safely and can be used safely. I know my ex-wife, she worked in a place in a manufacturing plant where they had a huge pipe of anhydrous ammonia going through the middle of the plant because it was their coolant systems. It was for their coolant, and it was safe. I mean, they upgraded often. If there was any sign of rust or any type of degradation, it was immediately replaced. So there is a way to handle this stuff safely, right?
That's an excellent point to make. The engineers I talked with said, look, we have the technology. It really isn't a question of technology. It's more of a question of human systems, of preventative maintenance, of training. And another aspect of the Clean Air Act that I think is important is that by disclosing this information, it gives the companies an incentive to invest in safer chemicals and processes. And that's what you're starting to see. Anhydrous ammonia is not used as much anymore for refrigeration as it used to be. Still a lot of it out there. But the companies are looking for a safer alternative.
And that is a pretty good place to leave that at. Bill, I really enjoyed the report. It gave me hope that someone out there is looking into this stuff, and I got to be honest, I was glad to hear that this was something that was in the pipeline before the spill in West Virginia. Because when I first read it, I go, well, hopefully now we'll start to see more of this investigative reporting in the aftermath. But you were actually doing this beforehand.
Yes, and I agree with you. There's a need for more.
It's just what we need to be working on. Bill Heltzel, I appreciate the time. Great article, and I'd like to have you come back and talk to us again at some point.
Okay, well, Rick, thanks so much for having me on the show.
Anytime. Thanks so much. Let's take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
But I do believe in what a crazy man can do.
Yeah! Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
There's a growing army of the working poor in our U.S. of A., and big contingents of it are now on the march. They're strategizing, organizing, and mobilizing against the immoral economics of inequality being hung around America's neck by the likes of Walmart, McDonald's, and colleges. Wait a minute. Colleges? You go there to get ahead in life. More education makes you better off, right? Well, ask a college professor about that. You know, the ones who earn PhDs and are now teaching America's next generation? The sorry secret of higher education, from community colleges to brand-name universities, is that they've embraced the corporate culture of a contingent workforce, turning professors into part-time, low-paid, no-benefit, no-tenure, temporary teachers. Overall, more than half of America's higher ed faculty members today are, quote, adjunct professors, meaning they are attached to the school but not essentially a part of it. It also means that these highly educated, fully credentialed professors have become part of America's army of the working poor. They never know until a semester starts whether they'll teach one class, three, or none. Typically, this leaves them with take-home pay somewhere between zero and maybe $1,000 a month. Poverty. Adjuncts usually get no benefits, no real chance of earning full-time positions, no due process or severance pay if dismissed, no say in curriculum or school policies, not even office space. Like their counterparts at Walmart and McDonald's, adjunct college professors are not treated as valuable resources to be nurtured, but as cheap, exploitable, and disposable labor. This is Jim Hightower saying, unsurprisingly, this contingent of the low-wage army is organizing too. For information, contact New Faculty Majority at www.newfacultymajority.info. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
Nation that relies on its miners not do everything in its power to protect them. How can we let anyone in this country put their lives at risk by simply showing up to work, by simply pursuing the American dream? We cannot bring back the 29 men we lost. They are with the Lord now. Our task here on earth is to save lives from being lost in another such tragedy. To do what we must do individually and collectively to assure safe conditions underground, to treat our miners like they treat each other, like a family, because we are all family and we are all Americans.
I think it's time for change. It's time to rearrange.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. You know, I listen to this. You go through and you look at this huge hole in the ground that we saw and think that could have been prevented. Could have been the end of it. And the lives lost. And, you know, I keep asking the question, you know, could it be in our backyard? And those who keep pushing this, we need to deregulate, we need to unleash business. Look, I think Bill's right. You know, the reality is most people do play by the rules. Most people play by the standards that are put there. Because they don't want to run afoul of the law. And look, they don't want to be the pariah, but there are some. There are some bad actors. There are some outliers. Cut costs. You know, and then who does it affect? And, you know, I've had this conversation a number of times with folks who say, well, you know, it's private property. They should be able to do what they want. And I go back and I think about, you know, some of the jobs I've had in the past and some of the things that I've seen over the years. And I wonder, you know, like in West or at Freedom Industries, if those workers had the freedom to join and form collectively a union to say, you know what? We think that things can be done better. One of the things, and this is, you know, I just had this conversation with a young guy the other day. One of the things that unions do is protect the companies from themselves, because the people who are closest to a problem, they're the ones who have the ability to say, hey, I'm going to speak up because there's a problem here. There's something wrong here. And, you know, as I stood there, and, you know, we took my whole family was there, and we were just kind of in awe of what we were seeing in West. Because there was nothing there. It was like a ghost town. We were walking up and down the streets that surrounded this facility, and nothing. There was a school there that, you know, probably hundreds of kids went to. Not a sound. You heard crickets. There was a nursing home where, you know, that was the place where, you know, I'm sure more than dozens of people lived. Empty. Silence. homes surrounding this with all the windows blown out of it, the doors off of it, and just piles of trash waiting to be picked up and moved away. It was really very eerie. It reminded me almost of when we were in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, and how, you know, even a year or so afterwards, it was all abandoned. It was empty. There was nothing there. There was writing on the walls of, you know, how many dead and how many dead animals, and, you know, there was this code on the walls. Same thing you saw in West. As the first responders went through, they marked the walls to say, hey, you know, this is what we found and this is what was there. It was really eerie and scary and on so many levels. Just very, very weird. And, you know, as I look at it and I think about it, nobody wants that in their backyard. Nobody wants that headache. Nobody wants that trouble. It's just, well, it is what it is. Let's go to the phone. It's got Jake on line one. How are you doing tonight, Jake?
Hey, Rick. I thought I'd call in and make a comment about Penn State.
Uh-oh.
There's been a lot of publicity about the new coach, James Franklin. By all accounts, Penn State hit a real home run. The so-called experts, and you know there's a lot of them out there that make a living.
And there you are.
And here I am unemployed. What the common consensus is that Penn State got the best available coach in the entire country.
Good for him.
That happened after Bill O'Brien stayed 2 years. Bill O'Brien took over after Joe Paterno was unceremoniously dumped, and then he died. And Penn State, with Dr. Joyner, conducted a search for a new coach, came up with Bill O'Brien. He stayed 2 years. The same Dr. Joyner was in charge of the search this time. He's the temporary athletic director. Now, the relevance in all this is that goes back to something that we all think, that some people think they know a lot about, may or may not, and that is the Sandusky scandal. Now, what's the relevance? I think being in a political year, I think some of this situation, I think we need to remind people about how political that whole situation is. You had a governor, Governor Corbett, who attended his first Board of Trustees meeting and behind the scenes, in fact, did work to get Joe Paterno fired and bragged about it. That angered a lot of Penn State alumni and Penn State faithful. And by the way, Rick, Penn State has the largest alumni association in the country. So there's a lot of them out there. A lot of, obviously, a lot of them in Pennsylvania. And a lot of them are Republican. Now, the relevance is they're angry at Corbett for that. Kathleen Kane, to be really political, who ran for attorney general, ran with the promise of conducting an investigation into the conduct of then Attorney General Corbett.
Okay, and that's got to be coming out soon, right?
Well, I don't know when it's coming out. I haven't heard when, and I would assume that it comes out. It's going to come out before the election. You would hope so. And she's going to conduct an investigation, and the truth is that his conduct is, let's say, doesn't pass the smell test. I mean, in that 3-year period where he's supposed to be conducting an investigation into all the shenanigans, there was a large amount of time where he didn't have anybody investigating him. Why? Because he had all his people up on the Hill investigating the pay scandal.
Right.
And, of course, that led to him
becoming
being
governor.
High profile, and he piggybacked off that to become the governor. Yeah. Now, the question remains, was his conduct less than sleazy? Did it violate the law? Was he responsible for conduct unbecoming? I mean, you can make the case that maybe, just maybe, the fact that during that 3-year window where he started the investigation and brought charges, there was a good amount of time where he had nobody investigating Sandusky.
Well, it wasn't important.
Did that allow Sandusky to abuse more boys? Did it allow him to violate the law to a greater degree than he did? And I think the people of Pennsylvania Now, if you think this is political, you look at Kathleen Kane, and two things happened in Pennsylvania, and I'm sure you're aware of it, Rick, that never happened before. One, the Democrats won the Attorney General's office. Kathleen Kane, I mean, she has that wow factor. It's not just the Penn State schedule or a scandal. She has a wow factor. I think she could be a very formidable candidate if she chooses to seek higher office. But beyond that, she did extremely well in an area of the state that traditionally had been Republican. Now,
yeah.
Center County went in 2008, the first time went slightly Democratic.
So you think that has to do with the Penn State scandal? Rep, if you, about 30 seconds. Give it to me.
Well, wrapping this up, I think Corbett, on top of all the issues, and you've talked about them, we're talking about taking $1 billion off education, the sale of the lottery, the sale of the wine and spirits, his signing of a voter ID law, his promise to sign a right-to-work law, all those issues are going to hurt him. But on top of that, I have a large number of Republicans that are going to vote against him, and it all centers around what happened in Penn State over the weekend, that whole Penn State situation.
That's good. That's good to hear, Jake. I appreciate it. And let's hope that those Republicans think that way. Appreciate it, man. Talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks, Rick.
Let's take a quick break. Right back with Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
7 years and I'll go to work at night. I got no time for living, yeah, 'cause in my life I got better than I think I am. I guess that's why they call me the Comedy Working Man. Making the Blue Bloods see red. The Rick Smith Show.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Hillary Tone. A report by Maria Shriver in the Center for American Progress showed that closing the gender pay gap would add billions to the economy and cut the poverty rate among women and their families in half. On Fox News' The O'Reilly Factor, host Bill O'Reilly questioned whether the Shriver report was a big deal, asking his guest Kirsten Powers what the point is to drawing attention to the gender wage gap.
There's still income inequality that women are making, I think, 77 cents on the dollar as compared to men. So I consider that to be a pretty serious issue.
Do you think the government should guarantee equal wages?
Well, I don't think there's really any way that they could guarantee equal wages.
So then what's the point of what?
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. It was today, back in the year of 1920, that the, it just blows my mind that thousands of folks who were held during the Palmer raids, they won the right to meet with lawyers and get representation at deportation hearings. Habeas what? No, I don't need that. If you remember back in history, what had happened is you had this this Alexander Mitchell Palmer, who at the time was a U.S. Attorney General under Woodrow Wilson, on this anti-communist, anti-socialist, because those people are organizing, and we can't have them asking for money. And he was going through the country deporting people like crazy. And most of them without any access to an attorney or their constitutional rights. It was just out the door. Habeas what? Nothing. Anyway, let's find out what's going on around the world. I've got Luke Vargas, Talk Radio News Service. Luke, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, good evening.
So I understand some goings-on at the Geneva peace talks.
Or lack of. These talks, which are supposed to create a transitional government for this country, are set to begin in Geneva in 6 days, and we just learned this morning that the most prominent internal Syrian political group, a moderate one at least, they're called the Syrian National Coordination Committee, they said this morning they're not going to go. They gave a pretty fiery rationale for that, saying what's required of a Syrian is to obey the will of the international community in a scenario that has been prepared in advance to determine our destiny. So they don't like the fact that the U.S. and others were seemingly in charge of setting the guest list for this. But, I've looked at this guest list. There are 30 different countries who are being invited, so this seems to be a pretty open-door policy. And maybe that's what they're upset about. But a lot of the frustration on the opposition side at this point boils down to the fact that the Assad government is going to be sending about 9 people there, including the foreign minister. But they've been increasingly clear over the last few weeks that they're not going to be listening to this thing called the Geneva Communique, which was signed, agreed to last year at the first of these talks, that basically said, when we create a transitional government for the future of this country, it's going to be agreed to by consensus, and thus probably wouldn't include the Assad government. Now, the Assad delegation is saying, hey, we're not so sure. It's sort of in flux. We agree with a lot of that, but, you know, we'll just have to get there first before we decide how much we're willing to do it. And these opposition parties are saying, no way, if you're not going to be held to those terms, then why are we going to bother showing up? And we're seeing today the first big coalition of the opposition decide not to come, and tomorrow morning we'll hear from the Syrian National Council, the biggest external, they're based in Turkey, political group about what their plans are. And you know, judging by their recent rhetoric and what their partners in the country are saying, I wouldn't be surprised if they say no also. And then you've got this really unpleasant outcome where the two biggest political groups organizing on behalf of the Syrian opposition aren't going to be at the conference. So you'll have the Assad government negotiating with the Philippines and Denmark and not with their actual opponents in the country. And that spells a complete failure.
Yeah, and then nothing going forward, except more chaos, I would guess, right?
Yeah, I mean, even if these two groups were there, I think they have their work cut out for them. You know, it doesn't take a genius to realize that, but if they're not there, things will break down even faster. So I guess I'll be tuning in, you know, very early tomorrow morning to see what decision was made in Istanbul from the Syrian National Coalition. But if they don't go, I think it's going to be a mad scramble at the UN tomorrow, as well as at the State Department, probably less so in Moscow, where they really don't care if these talks fall apart, trying to do damage control here and say, look, there's still hope for a political future for this country, even though the only political organ at this point that could really end this conflict is dead in the water. So really there are very few options here if the other group doesn't decide to go tomorrow.
Now, I understand that we had pledged to give them some money at some point, right?
Not the group that I just was talking about that decided not to go today, but, yeah, the Syrian National Coalition, they're the people that Zach Vador talked with and interviewed a lot of their top people. I've actually met some of them at the UN. They were responsible for a large period of time over the past year for receiving the non-lethal aid that the U.S. was giving. And then they would distribute it to the Free Syrian Army and other people. We decided to discontinue that aid in early December when it was realized that some extremist groups had raided the warehouses that had been storing the stuff. And we just said, look, we like you guys politically speaking, but you're not in a position to guarantee the safety of the things we give you, which, you know, is very much the case. And consequently, we pulled our non-lethal aid. So the U.S. is trying to threaten them with something else, saying we're going to remove your political support if you don't come to this conference. But at this point, there's not too much more we can pull away from the opposition because, you know, in total, we really haven't given them too much.
Right.
So, again, not much for the U.S. to do here except for, I think, to watch all these opposition groups find a rationale internally for why they don't want to go.
And while you have this back and forth, what happens to the hundreds of thousands of refugees that are in Turkey and in Lebanon and other places?
Well, the ones that are in other countries, again, are going to be, you know, have a slightly more cheerful situation because the aid agencies are getting some. We've been learning a lot this week, though, about some sites within Syria that the Assad government had ostensibly okayed certain humanitarian deliveries to access. One is this Yarmouk camp where I just looked at the cover, I think it's of the Independent in England that is going to run a very disturbing front page photo tomorrow of starving children in that camp. The Assad government said, okay, the UN, you can come and give a delivery to this camp, but instead of going in through the easy entrance, we're going to make you go into this other entrance to the camp, which means going something like 25 miles through a war zone. And lo and behold, as the UN was about to deliver aid, food, I think, rations to about 10,000 people yesterday, they were shot at, they had to turn around, the Assad government said, oh, that's so sad, we'll try to figure out a way to do this week, but they are doing everything they can to find excuses not to fulfill their obligations to allow, you know, actors like the UN to come in and deliver aid. And, gosh, there's really no hope, I think, at this point, of the UN being able to wield much over the Assad government, particularly because they're working with them on the chemical weapons extraction, and at least for the next few months, depend on a good relationship with them in order to guarantee the security of UN people in the country, and that really makes it hard to slap their wrists over anything.
Yeah, no matter how you look at this, and you know, and I go back to George Washington and the stay clear of foreign entanglements. To me, there looks like there's no side that we can choose that will be on the right side. It's all shades of less bad.
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting dynamics of the very, you know, immediate situation on the ground in Syria is that the tides are sort of turning. It is an intractable stalemate. That's the language I think we were using about a year ago on this very show. But every month or so, there seems to be a change in dynamics. And for the moment, the opposition is looking at the fact that the Syrian government has deployed its troops. They only have a certain number of actual troops. They can bomb the heck out of a number of sites at once. But when it comes to ground troops, they're working with a smaller group of people, and they had to redeploy them to areas to monitor fighting between different elements of the opposition. That's something we've been seeing a lot recently, the Free Syrian Army fighting extremist groups like Al-Qaeda and Al-Nusra. And so the Syrian Army has gone to those places to try to see what's going on. And, as a result, there have been some gains for the opposition in various areas. Territory the Assad government had won is now back in opposition hands. So I think if you just look at the headlines over the past few weeks, it doesn't put these opposition groups in a position of feeling like their backs are against the wall. Maybe they should go to Geneva to talk. They were being held in December, I think these groups would be more willing to perhaps go because the tide was you know, flowing away from them. It's a very sad turn of events when all these groups, I think, are paying so close attention to these short and really ultimately insignificant gains and perhaps not participating fully in the political process because of the hope that they can turn the tide. I really think that's not going to happen no matter how many small victories you can string together in a period of a week or so.
Just bad news all the way around. Let's maybe some good news in Egypt. No constitution, I guess, but what's going on in Egypt?
Hey, they do have a constitution. The results have not been officially announced, but we do have a very good indication from state media that the referendum on the constitution, basically written up by the military over the last few months, has passed with 95% approval. Look at that.
Wow.
This basically will pave the way for the general who is currently overseeing that country, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. He's a name you should probably write down because he will likely win the presidency, and I would guess serve for a good long while because a lot of people in the country, it certainly helps when you ban your political opposition and arrest them for protesting the constitutional vote. But, you know, the people that are voting in Egypt and are being politically expressive and are legally allowed to do so at this point really do just want an end to violence. They want some restored security, and it looks like they're more willing now at this point to find that security in the form of someone who has some, you know, very many people would think was responsible for a coup, has orchestrated sort of a power grab for the military with a lot of the provisions in the Constitution demand, for example, that the defense secretaries for the next decade are picked from among people in the army. A lot of things here ban political opposition parties, namely any religious parties being centered around religious identity, which was brotherhood. So he's got his way. He will likely announce his run for president this weekend when the results are finally verified. And this is the Egypt I think we might be stuck with for the next 2 years. Yeah. Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, the new president.
I better get to work on figuring out how to say that 10 times fast. Any opposition? I mean, I like the 95% of the people voted for the Constitution. And the first thought came up, 95%, who got the vote? And then the other question, who didn't?
Well, a lot of people could vote. Even the Muslim Brotherhood, the sympathizers could vote, but their basically way of doing the no vote was to abstain. So you had 40%. Turnout, which is a little higher than when the Constitution was voted on during the Morsi years. It's still kind of low, though, so if you're looking at maybe where those no votes came from, they most likely came from people staying at home and not voting. There were about 400 people reported arrested in the streets, people who were hanging up posters that had slogans about why you should vote no. The Egyptian encryption authorities kept going on their state information website to publish messages to journalists around the world saying it's not illegal to campaign against this constitutional referendum, but every indication we had is that they were more than willing to arrest people for campaigning with no party. They arrested an Associated Press photographer for taking photos of people hanging up no posters. So, you know, I guess 95% sends the message to Egyptians who wanted to receive the message of strong military power and the end of the political opposition. But a lot of people will say the opposition in that country is alive and well. It just wasn't out there voting.
Yeah, another one of those scenarios where a yes vote is a big black X on a piece of paper, a no vote is no X, and they put it in a clear plastic box with the guy with the assault rifle right next to the box. Yeah, your freedom to vote. What's going on in South Sudan? I know more chaos there.
Yeah, there's some improvement on the security of people in the UN camp, but we had a very disturbing report published by Human Rights Watch today that sort of traced the events that occurred in mid-December when all this violence kicked off. They sent a research team there to talk to people about some of the violence that occurred there in the first few days, and some of the stories they've told. I've recapped it in a feature on talkradionews.com. A lot of ethnically targeted violence against civilians, government soldiers going house to house in the capital, asking, saying something in the Nuer language, which is the language of one of the biggest tribes in the country, and if you responded in that language, they would shoot you. There was a case of about 300 men being put in a police headquarters overnight, and then in the morning, gunfire coming in through the windows, and almost all of them were killed, and their bodies trucked away. But then on the other side, you had, those of the opposite competing tribe or ethnicity committing also very disturbing acts, torching homes, people in them. You have to say at this point that there really is no side that has clean hands here. And again, just it looks like intractable positions. These are sides that go back quite a long way. They were the two major belligerents in the Sudan civil wars, the genocide of the past 2 decades or so. So this is a very disturbing report, not entirely surprising, but it does start to put names and numbers on the sort of uncertainty that was ruling that country about a month ago when violence started.
You know, as bad as we think we have it here, and as dysfunctional and as gridlocked as things sometimes appear here, you hear these stories from around the world, and you can be—I can be nothing but thankful to be here.
You're absolutely right. I'm actually considering a trip to go to Ethiopia in the next few weeks, where the peace talks are being held for the South Sudan crisis. I would not be going into the country, but would have the chance maybe to see some of the refugee camps where the South Sudanese are fleeing into Ethiopia. They're doing so in huge numbers. About 80,000 people have left the country, 400,000 people displaced internally. Again, these numbers, whether it's in Central Africa and Syria, start to get a little bit mind-numbing, but they're all a little bit different in some way. And I hope to keep reporting on it and keeping your audience abreast as well, possible.
We sure do appreciate it, I got to be honest, because this is stuff that, I don't know that a lot of people really want to think about, but I think it's important that we know. And when you look at the meager amount of foreign aid that we give out every year and the enormous good that it can do, it's to me worth continuing to talk about and look into. I'll talk about the last thing. I guess tomorrow it's going to be the president's going to give his speech on what's going on with the NSA.
Yes, 11 a.m. Everyone should tune in. It will be watched by many people at the UN. I'm certain about that. One of those American stories that does break through the bubble. He will be speaking at the Justice Department, an interesting place to hold a speech. He'll be announcing his plans for National Security Administration reforms. Some of the things he's expected to talk about are creating an independent privacy advocate who will ostensibly represent the public against the FISA courts, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Courts. Seems a little dubious to me that one person could so articulately defend the entire public interest against a mass of lawyers and generals and other people who are advocating probably very opposite positions in that case, but that is one of the reforms we will likely hear. And the other main one are added protections for non-Americans who are being sued on it. It seems like the White House is predominantly concerned at this moment about the impact on people in Europe and their very angry angry and probably more articulate reactions than many people, or informed reactions, that is, than people in the U.S. about what the U.S. has done spying on European countries. So that's, I think, where the greater protections will actually be put in place. And there's a good amount of, irony.
I mean, it's kind of like the whole thing with Richard Cordray, the head of the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, taking on all of Wall Street and being the guy who's protecting us from these corporate criminals. I see it in almost the same vein.
Yeah. It's a very frustrating one, especially when I'm looking at the list of reforms that were suggested to him and that he probably won't do anything about. I'll list only two of them because your audience might find them interesting. One was to have the head of the NSA appointed by the Senate, and also to be open to anyone, any civilian. It doesn't need to be a military position as it is now. And the other one is to have all 9 Supreme Court justices appoint people to the Visa Court. For the moment, it's entirely filled up with people at the discretion of the Chief Justice, which, again, really politicizes something which I don't think should ever be used in a partisan way. So those reforms will likely stay on the sidelines, but I guess tune in and maybe one of those perhaps more positive reforms will find its way into the president's plan.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what he comes out with tomorrow. For me, from my point of view, I would want somebody who doesn't have any military background. I don't want the General Boykins of the world. My God's bigger than your God, and we're going to bomb. I'm leery of that, but that's just me. Anyway, Luke, it's always great talking with you. Appreciate the input and the news. Thanks so much.
Take care. Have a great night.
Luke Vargas, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Time to talk.
Never you will look back again. You fight on to the end. Together we will live on forevermore. In this land we have defended. From all things dark and cruel, now we are defenseless.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Would you dive 14 feet deep into Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13. Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep...
It's time for change. It's time to rearrange.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me we're gonna make it somehow. I heard a wise man say revolution starts now. I think it's time for change.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can always email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Of course, if you missed any portion of the program, thericksmithshow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast, Stitcher on the smartphone, so much of that. An amazing night tonight, lots of stuff we got into, especially the TPP, this fast track authority. You got to contact your representatives, got to tell them, do your job, no to fast track authority. On the state level, you got to be calling your representatives in their ear off and say, hey, go do something that actually people want. Stop attacking working people. It is that simple, folks. But you got to pick up the phone. You got to make those calls. Again, if you missed any portion of the program, thericksmithshow.com, Stitcher on the smartphone. Thanks for being here. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time.